Radio WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, our good friend attorney Irwin Aronson going to be talking about the legislative session that was, all of the attacks that came down, be it unemployment compensation, be it this god-awful budget. Just the Voter ID Act, you name it, we're going to talk about it. And then maybe look down the road, what's going to come in the next session. We've already talked, the vouchers are coming. They're going to go after people's right to work. They're going to go after the fact that they just hate workers. And they have a whole agenda that's been sweeping across this country, trying to steal the right of people to collectively bargain. That's coming. And get ready for it. Also, this voucher thing, again, more theft of public education. It is coming. They've been very honest. They're going to want to privatize this state wine and spirit shops. They want to sell off everything. And there's part of me that goes, you know, maybe if we're going to go down this path, and if we're going to make this whole argument of core government functions, should we be in the business of owning houses? And if we're not, we should sell the governor's mansion. Maybe have businesses donate it back to us. Maybe for a small tax credit. That seems to be the radical rights game plan. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Hempstead, New York Mayor Wayne Hall about some of the things that they're doing to help, people stay in their homes and using the city resources to, encourage banks to help folks who are being foreclosed upon. By moving their money maybe somewhere else. It'll be an interesting conversation with him. And also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Jean Sassen. She's a board member of New York Communities for Change. And we're going to talk about his three-year foreclosure fight with Chase Bank. This whole foreclosure thing, I don't think it's getting enough play. I don't think it's getting enough attention. We're allowing people to be booted out of their homes, and these banks are doing nothing, in my opinion, to help them. And I say, well, why do we need to help them? Well, we need to help them because it stabilizes communities. If you have a bunch of empty homes, a bunch of foreclosed homes, you have communities that are struggling and that they're devaluing. And that harms everybody. So we're going to talk about that as well. Also in the second hour, Steve Raisley, United Steelworker Labor Activist, going to talk about this trade stuff, the trade agreements that are coming down, also the Reznor closing. I guess the state gave them some money, as I understand. They're outsourcing jobs at a time when we need every single job. We've got companies and we're funding it. In the third hour, Bob Lennox, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Secretary Treasurer of Local 495, going to be here talking about the BMW story we talked about last night. The fact that again, we got this. The BMW, who's very profitable, said we're not going to negotiate with our unionized workers. We're going to outsource those jobs to somebody else. We're going to have a third-party logistics company come in. We're going to fire all of our long-term employees, 30, 35-year employees, all of them out in the street. Maybe the company that comes in will hire, maybe they won't. But done. That's it. Swipe of a pen. And we're going to find out the fight that they're putting up, because, look, at the end of the day, they still have 70 people working together collectively to fight back. And, you make this as painful enough, maybe they change their mind. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So it's official. We've been talking about it for months. You knew it was coming. Today is the day. It is at the ink is dry by now. Mexican trucks will be allowed into the U.S. Congratulations. All of you truck drivers, start watching the roads, because you're going to be competing now for cross-border business. And I ask any of my truck driver friends, are you driving into Mexico? Are you willing to take your rig and your trailer and all that down into Mexico to deliver freight? Are you willing to go the other way? I gotta be honest, I'm saying there'd probably be no American drivers going the other way. Because, you stop and you look at the conditions down there. It's a country that I think is in the middle of a civil war, at least a massive drug war. The laws are completely different. And you have to deal with, and the stories are out there, corrupt police. We sometimes say, we've got some problems with ours. Nothing compared to what's going on down there. So I ask any of my truck driver friends, are you driving down the road? Are you willing to take your rig into Mexico to deliver a load? And if so, at what price? And what do you think is going to happen as we move down the road and this cross-border thing opens up and you start seeing Mexican trucks rolling across the border making 7-10 cents a mile for the guy sitting behind the wheel, 10 bucks a day? What's that going to do to the competition between American drivers and Mexican drivers? I'm waiting to see what happens. This is going to be a very interesting couple of months. Because they're not rolling across right now. The deal's been signed. They're now going to start opening up the borders and putting in place all of their things. And they're saying, they're going to put electronic on board electronic recorders on every truck. Evidently, we're going to be paying for all drug testing. We're going to be paying for all of the licensing. We're going to be paying for all of the onboard recorders. We're going to be paying for all of this stuff. The assessments, the driving reviews, all of that stuff, we're going to be paying for it. To test to make sure that the Mexican drivers coming in speak barely enough English to read the signs. We're going to pay for all of that. So congratulations, American taxpayer. That's what we got. And this is a cave to big business. Understand that. This is not anything having to do with labor. And the next Republican who tells me, the Obama administration's bought and paid for by big labor, I'm going to smack you, because you deserve a good smack across the back of the head. Because you're stupid. How can anybody in their right mind look at this decision and say this is a president who's bought and paid for by big labor? What this has done is basically wiping out long-haul trucking in this country. And beyond this, what I'm afraid of now, and it's very likely going to happen, you are going to see numerous warehouses in the southern part of the country leave that part. You probably even see, here in the northern part, some of these big warehouses they've put up and down 81, some of them they put over on 78. You may see those go, because now you're going to be able to run your operation out of there. Stop and think about that for a little while. I guarantee you, within a month, we're going to see Mexican drivers in this area, because they're able to come and deliver to location. So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes. And, I guess the big question is, and it's one that's been asked, will this opening up the border, will this cross-border cargo traffic, is this going to boost business? Is this going to allow owners to hire more workers? Is this going to be a good thing? Are we going to see growth? Is this, the panacea? Is this what they were telling us about NAFTA? Oh, we're going to be able to have so much activity. Or is this going to cost us more jobs? Or is it going to drive down an already starving industry. You know, most of my truck driver friends, most of the independents I know, they're starving. They're having a tough time making ends meet because there's so much competition out there, so much cutthroat competition. So that's the question. Our transportation secretary, Ray LaHood, he's saying, well, you know, could it be the first part of it? He writes in an email to the AP today saying, quote, by opening up the door to long-haul trucking between the U.S. and Mexico, America's third largest trading partner, we will create jobs and opportunity for our people and support economic development in both nations. And I'm going, yeah, how's that possible? Because you're going to end up firing all of those people on both sides of the border who were loading and unloading trucks, who were shuffling them around to make sure that they got crossed and they got inspected. All those people are now done. Both of those industries are gone. Now what you're going to have is you're going to have open borders and you're going to have people just rolling through. And we've already seen what happens to containers coming into our ports. We maybe inspect 1% of them. Maybe. So you got to wonder how many, now they say they're going to inspect every truck, but when traffic's backed up for 20 miles, do you think that's going to happen? Someone's just going to say, let them go. Let them roll. Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa says the agreement's probably illegal because it goes much further than the previously agreed upon pilot program. And he asks a very interesting question. Why would we be opening up the border to dangerous trucks at a time when we have high unemployment and Mexico has rampant drug violence? And I think it's an important question to ask. You know, why at this time is this important? Why at this time do we need to swing the doors open and say, come on in, roll them on in? Well, it's because Mexico was smart. And you got to give smart people credit when they do things that benefit them. They slapped a bunch of tariffs on us, I guess somewhere around $2.4 billion worth of tariffs on very targeted groups, mostly agriculture, mostly the growing industries, mostly the cattle industries, you know, the folks who squeal a lot, who get really well funded by the, you know, by the farm bill, people who have a lot of pull in Washington. And now you see, you know, a bunch of these groups, you know, they're all tingly in the panties from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, you know, right down to the tree growers. They're all giddy. The Chamber of Commerce, simply giddy, happy as can be. What this is going to do, really stop and think about what this is going to do. This is going to lower the price of labor driving trucks back and forth. You know, you're going to be able to drop that per mile rate down from about $1 a mile down to somewhere around 78 cents. That's a lot of profit. That means that guy you're paying sitting behind the wheel, making half, maybe less than half, a quarter. That's a big savings, and that's not going to get passed on to you, the consumer. And all of the redundancy at the borders, the people unloading and loading the different trailers. And I got news for you. I can't wait to see what happens to the first American truck driver who goes, well, you know what, I'm going to go do it. And he gets down into Mexico, and they strip his truck dry. And those shiny bumpers are gone. Can't wait to see that. And then I can't wait to see what happens when they go to the Mexican government and say, you got to make this guy whole. And they go, keep dreaming. Not going to happen. So, you know, again, you know, I got to give the Mexicans credit. They were smart. They held us hostage, another hostage-type situation. They're going to cut the tariffs within 10 days. And then once we allow all the trucks from Mexico into the U.S., they're going to take the tariffs off. And again, some people win. A couple of the cattle people and the tree growers and the orange people and the grape people, they're going to do okay. They're going to be happy. They think they're going to, you know, be able to push their goods into Mexico, and they probably will. But the roads of this country are going to get that much more dangerous. And the wages of the drivers are going to get that much lower. This is a bad thing. It was a bad idea in 94. It's a bad idea now. Now, understand, they were supposed to have full access in 2000. It's been held off 11 years because it's a bad idea. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around. Right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Sting is saying, "Don't stand so close to me," to the state oil company of Kazakhstan. The rocker canceled a concert planned in the country to show his solidarity with oil workers who have been on strike. In a statement, the former frontman of The Police said, "Hunger strikes, imprisoned workers, and tens of thousands on strike represent a virtual picket line, which I have no intention of crossing." Sting has long been a supporter of Amnesty International, which is the organization that petitioned Sting to reconsider hosting a concert in the country. The workers have been on strike since May 26th, and Sting had planned to play at a festival celebrating the founding of the country's capital, Astana. Should U.S. labor have a more radical response to the anti-labor movement? Doug Cunningham reports.
Laborers International Union of North America President Terrence O'Sullivan says it's time for a more radical labor movement in light of the strong attacks on fundamental labor rights. O'Sullivan's remarks came during the 125th anniversary of May Day, commemorated in Chicago's Haymarket Square. It was a rededication of the newly restored monument at the grave of the four Haymarket martyrs, executed in 1887 for the Haymarket bombing. That bombing happened during a rally for the eight-hour day.
Just as the men and women of Haymarket stood united and stood fearless in the face of corporate terror, today we must stand united and stand fearless in the face of corporate tyranny. Instead of being at the wrong end of a Pinkerton's baton, working men and women today are at the wrong end of a lawmaker's gavel or a governor's pen. Targets of wealthy special interests who don't want us standing in the way of their greedy agenda. When we're fighting just to hold on to our very lives, there is no movement too radical and there is no movement too militant.
O'Sullivan audio, courtesy of WORT Radio in Madison.
Michigan has long had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. The last time the state saw a rate not in the double digits was in November of 2008. However, Michigan Republican and House Ways and Means Committee Chair Dave Camp plans to move forward on three free trade agreements Thursday without the consideration of a plan by the Obama administration to extend aid for workers who lose jobs to overseas competition. President Barack Obama has suggested he won't move forward with the trade agreements unless they include the aid for U.S. workers, which expired in February of this year.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
All right, well, that's what's going to have to happen. You're going to have to stand up, fight back. I mean, you look at this budget. Again, I can't get my head off of it. The people that are going to be harmed by this, and all the news reports that they made the tough decisions, and this was hammered out, and it was hard work. No, it wasn't. This is what we were talking about back in January. What they were going to do, they did exactly what they were expected to do. They beat up on the people who were on their knees. They beat up on the people who were on the ground. That's what they do. Anyway, I've got our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, on the line. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, always good to take time for a worthy cause, and I can think of none more worthy than the people who are listening to this show tonight.
All right, I hope you had a great holiday weekend.
Well, you know, I get to celebrate my dependence on Independence Day because it happens to be my wedding anniversary.
Oh,
so it's always a great holiday for us.
Beautiful. Congratulations. You know, the last time you sounded much better spirits. The last time we talked, you seemed kind of down, batteries charged, ready to go back and take this on?
Well, my batteries were never discharged, but ability to run the engine was a little bit shifted last week as I watched our General Assembly kowtowing to a governor who puts the needs of the multi-rich ahead of the multitudes get his way. And it's frustrating and it's downright devastating if you're a kid to go into school or the parent of a child who you hoped would go to a decent university, or if you're a senior, or if you are a person with physical or intellectual disabilities and happen to live in Pennsylvania. If you're somebody who's out of work or underemployed, if you're somebody who needs help with energy payments in a cold winter, or who needs help with housing in a hot summer, this governor and the majority of members of the General Assembly have said, tough, you got to tighten your belt. But on the other hand, if you're a business, you got a tax break. If you're wealthy, you continue to not have to pay your fair share. If you are capable of organizing your business in Delaware or offshore, you got a bonus. So we all know who fits where and why and what. We understand that education is no longer a priority for the state. We understand that that whole notion of our Constitution that speaks about an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is not really a constitutional right. That's a right for the multi-rich.
Yeah, you know,
and politically confirmed last week.
You know, and looking at this, did they make the tough, in your opinion, did they make the tough choices? I mean, this was a budget that the Republicans really pained over?
Oh, they pained over which of their buds was going to get a break. Didn't seem to be a whole lot of pain or a whole lot of conversation or even a whole lot of attention to the idea that they are attempting to dismantle public education, one of the specific constitutional duties of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for its citizens. They didn't seem to have a lot of pain involved in some of the ancillary legislation that did things like taking away the right of people who prove they have been harmed by someone or some entity, but that entity has found a way to avail themselves of protection under the bankruptcy code. So even after you've proven they hurt you, you won't collect. They didn't seem to be a problem with that. There didn't seem to be much of a problem, a whole lot of agony over the idea of basically saying there will no longer be any meaningful school construction in this state or any meaningful ability of public sector unions and school districts to represent their members, because by capping the amount that goes to the Pennsylvania Public School Employee Pension Fund from school districts, they have, by definition, capped the wages that people working in those school districts can get. So I don't see that as a lot of pain. I see that as a lot of bull.
And exactly what we expected that they would do.
Oh, was as predictable, Rick, as the sun coming up tomorrow morning.
So where does this all take us from?
But intriguingly, they didn't announce that in November when they were running. They announced it in February or March when they were converting their electoral victory into private public policy. So where do we go from here? We go where we always go. We roll up our sleeves and we petition our government, but mostly we shine a light and hold up a mirror. And in these 2 months that members of the General Assembly have rewarded themselves with, after passing this budget of vacation time, of not being in the state capitol to do the business for which they were elected, that is to legislate public policy, but instead to hang out at home and do whatever it is they do while they pick up their paychecks and their car allowances and their office allowances and their staff allowances, it is for us to petition them and ask them to start explaining and to ask them why it is appropriate for businesses to get yet another tax break, for businesses to go through yet another cycle of not paying their fair share to finance unemployment compensation while workers pay on every single penny they earn. Why it is that they should feel proud that they made the hard choice of defunding public education, of defunding our public university, of defunding adult basic health care, of defunding program after program for the poor, for the sick, for the needy, for the indigent, while giving their buds a break, while not addressing the special tax breaks for big business. It is for all of us to petition our legislators while they're hanging out at home, while they're at their swimming pools or at their grills, or loading up the car for yet another vacation with their families that our families can no longer afford, and ask how they did it, what was so hard about making that choice, and remind them by shining the light and holding up the mirror that the choice they made should be now recognized for what it is, and make it be hard.
And that's what we need to be doing. And what I've been talking about is, you know, when they come back, there are a number of issues that are going to be front and center. The privatization of education, the privatization of wine and spirit shops, basically the selling off of state assets and state responsibilities. And I've been saying, you know, if those aren't core government functions, I don't think owning a house is a core government function either. We should sell the governor's mansion.
Well, I think we should sell the governor's mansion first, and I think that we probably need to even look closer at the lieutenant governor's mansion. But the lieutenant governor's mansion out at Indiantown Gap got a special grant of $74,000 in the budget to make a new pool for him and his family, while a whole lot of people are having to make these choices about what to do without health care. And how are they going to get to send their children to school? Because while we were defunding education and while we're pursuing with vigor, apparently, this privatization of our publicly owned assets, we feel it necessary to buy four new vehicles for the governor and his wife, the lieutenant governor and his wife, and to put a new pool in at Indiantown Gap for the lieutenant governor's family to take a dip during the long, hot summer while everybody's on break. And remember, of course, the only couple of constitutional duties of the lieutenant governor. You know, one is to be president of the Senate. Well, that's not much work when the Senate's not in session for two consecutive months. And the other is to be involved in local government attention. And I guess vacation starts there, too. And the third is to be involved with emergency management activities. And presumably there isn't an emergency that they're going to create now that they've defunded the budget that would pay for dealing with that. So I guess he's going to have a lot of time to spend by the pool that we're about to fix.
I say we all get our suits and our towels and we head over to his house, knock on the door and say, you know, we paid for it. We should be able to use it.
I think that more importantly, we should say that we paid for it. And since our local school districts and our local communities have been defunded and can't open the local pools like the one up on 6th Street in Harrisburg, that we should be permitted and, you know, assumed to be using that pool. And, you know, let's go. I'm not that handsome in a bathing suit, but I'm ready to lead that charge.
There you go. There's an idea. That's something we need to do. That is a good idea.
I think so, and I think it might be a whole lot of fun because it happens that the lieutenant governor's mansion is on a military base. Back in the day when I served as counsel to the office of lieutenant governor, when the Honorable Catherine Baker Knoll was lieutenant governor, that pool was out of commission. And Catherine, unlike her apparent view, the view of her apparent successor now, said that she wouldn't take or accept a penny of public funds to repair that swimming pool, that it wasn't right, it wasn't fair, it wasn't just when people were suffering, that she should be granted such luxury. Instead, she used that money to make sure children would be able to be admitted to the Civil War Museum. In fact, reached into her own pocket to make sure that school children who toured the Capitol got to spend time with the lieutenant governor, and she never let them go without giving them something to eat and tickets to this Civil War Museum or a personal guided tour of the William Penn Museum down on 3rd Street in Harrisburg, the State Museum. But these are different times. You've read it. You've heard it. Our listeners have certainly seen it in the newspapers. It's time for us to tighten our belts.
Yeah.
That's why we can only buy 4 new cars for the gubernatorial families and redo only 1 swimming pool.
Yeah, and speaking about Catherine Baker Knoll, she was a wonderful person. In fact, was very, very nice to my daughter, who, like you said, gave her a tour of her office, and a wonderful book, that was signed by, name eludes me right now, but, very nice of her and a very nice woman.
Well, she was a wonderful person, and, my life and my family's life is and has been enriched by our time with Catherine and getting to know her and having the opportunity to have a much more personal relationship with her than many people got, although she was, to the last moments of her life, very much the retail public servant, and she touched people one at a time. My wife, Nancy, who you know, is fond of telling stories about Lieutenant Governor Knoll being at our home, and after dinner, grabbing a dish towel and standing next to my wife at the sink and drying dishes while I was shoved off someplace else to get out of the way of the women doing the real work in that house.
I'm the one who's given the towel. See, now in my house it would have been me taking the towel and the two of them going off and doing the real work.
Well, I threw in the towel a long time ago on that subject.
But before we go, you know, I really do think, you know, this budget was being as bad as it was. The pain is yet to come. I do think in the fall when they come back, it is going to be the attacks are coming fast and furious early and often. They're talking about passing some 190 bills, and I would say the vast majority of them bad for you and me.
Oh, I would say that beyond the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, the what superlative you care to use. But more importantly, before we get into that prospective legislative agenda, the impact of the budget has to this point been found exclusively in the words and the cantations of people like you and me telling people what was going to happen as we get through the summer and particularly when we get to the fall. And as we look at local school district budgets with massive chaos and school buildings being closed, and understand that because they close a school building doesn't mean that the taxpayers aren't still paying for the overhead of that building. Those buildings still have to be heated. The snow next winter will still have to be shoveled on the sidewalks around that school building. The grass still will need to be cut this summer, even though the buildings are being mothballed as far as educational institutions. Those charges aren't going to go away. Those school budgets that are being slashed, even as taxes must be increased, are going to move on, and people will be placed in situations where health care is being denied them. Kids of parents who have been students at Pitt, Penn State, Temple, the 14 state-owned universities in the state system of higher ed, Lincoln University and Cheney out in the eastern part of the state, folks are going to be making choices that involve not sending their kids back to school because of massive tuition increases. And that's just the start of it. And we are told just today how happy we should be because in the Lehigh Valley, Amazon announced that as a result of the nature of Pennsylvania's budget, they're going to expand their facility and employ 300 more people in seasonal minimum wage jobs, so that they can mail things out to folks in other states on which we will not collect sales tax. And so out in the Lehigh Valley where we once made steel that was the backbone that won a war in 1945, where 23 or 24,000 people had family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining benefits that nobody talked about as they evaporated, we're now to celebrate 300 part-time minimum wage jobs at Amazon. So at a place where people once made money, we now are spending it.
Excellent.
Congratulations. And, oh, the postscript to that story, yeah, I almost forgot. Amazon got $2 million from your state government, from we taxpayers, to build that facility to employ low-wage workers and ship our jobs out of the United States and out of Pennsylvania as they sell electronics that were made in China.
Isn't that nice of us?
We are a generous lot, aren't we?
You know, lastly, before we go, you know, I go back to the kid one college student I met here when they had a big rally. He said, you know, the factory's been closed down in my town where my grandfather and my father worked for many years. That option isn't there for me. If I don't get an education, if I'm unable to graduate, there's nowhere for me to go back to. And I think of that kid often. I think of what this budget's done to that kid. And it breaks my heart.
Well, it breaks my heart, too. But once we get past having broken hearts, we need to do what I've spent the last week doing since we last talked on air. And that is gathering ourselves up and gathering myself up and getting ready, getting prepared to see what this is. I am the most loyal of Pennsylvanians. I am the most patriotic of Americans, and I have no embarrassment in saying that and in living that. But part of that loyalty, part of that patriotism, compels me and should compel all of us to speak out. And if this somehow works, if this draconian budget that so targets the defenseless and the needy turns out in the long run to make this a better place, I commit to you today, and I commit to everyone listening to this show, and I commit to Governor Corbett that I will strive to be the first in line to flatter and compliment them. But on the other hand, if it does what we have every reason to anticipate, I will shine a light, and I will stand as a mirror in front of every member of the General Assembly that voted for this poison, and make them see their reflections and make it certain that the people who live in their districts and have a right to vote for or against them know what they did and make those choices in the next election cycle, not based on the press releases that people put out about Amazon creating 300 jobs because we passed this phony budget, but to explain instead why they did what they did, for whom they did it, and to whom they did it.
And to make them eat their words. And I think Representative Mustillo, who said this.
It's a teachable moment for all of our students on how to live within your means and not become whiners.
How to live within your means and not become whiners.
I said this a bit last week. Representative Mark Mustillo is someone I know. He's someone that I have spent time with and worked with. He is not an inherently bad human being. In context, he said what he had been fed in that General Assembly, in that culture, at that time. Unlike many in the General Assembly of the slash-and-burn crowd, Representative Mustillo really is somebody who does have a heart. He is someone with whom we can have honest disagreements. But he's not a disagreeable human being. He is not of the ilk of others in the General Assembly who relish the opportunity to hammer students, who relish the opportunity to strip seniors of their access to health care, who relish the opportunity to victimize the poor, to victimize the lame, to victimize the disabled, to focus and drill on children with autism and other devastating and debilitating conditions and diseases. Mustillo is not there. Others are. This is no longer, and I've said this before on this show, a war between the Democratic model and the Republican model. This is a war between those of us who depend on our government do the things we cannot competently do for ourselves and everybody else. And I don't care any longer whether they're Democrats or Republicans or Hottentots. I care where they stand on the issues that affect the people I'm privileged to represent.
And I look at this vote, and it comes down to the vote on this budget for me. And, you know, I don't know Representative Mustillo. I do know what he said. And that to me...
I don't disagree with you on the point. I no longer afford myself the luxury of singling people out because of their political affiliation. We will.
I didn't say the representative was a Democrat or a Republican. I just played what he said.
I understand. We are in a mode where we will succeed by supporting our friends and opposing all others, regardless of political affiliation.
Right there with you.
And we also are going to be hopefully smart enough and wise enough that while we shine a light on people, we also recognize that we have to work with those who are holding the keys to the store.
Yep.
And we're going to fight them where we can. We're going to beat them when we can. And we're going to work with them as we can.
Exactly. Irwin, I appreciate the time. Always great to talk to you. Always informative. I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Looking forward to it myself. Peace and good luck to all. And take care. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too, Irwin. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
America's long, long war in Afghanistan has drained more than 1,500 precious lives and about $500 billion from our country. But finally, this enormous outlay paid off with the capture and killing of that al-Qaeda demon, Osama bin Laden, who attacked America and was the reason our military went into Afghanistan. Oh, wait, Osama wasn't in Afghanistan, was he? He was comfortably ensconced in Pakistan, whose leaders are supposedly our allies. And it wasn't the costly Afghan war effort that got bin Laden. It was old-time spy work, culminating in a raid involving a small team of Navy SEALs, a dog, and two helicopters. So why have two presidents and a decade of Congresses dumped so many lives and so much money into a country that poses no threat to us? Hardly a powerhouse, Afghanistan is an impoverished, anarchic, largely illiterate land of ancient tribal factions and fractious warlord fiefdoms. They have no desire or ability to attack us. The only reason we're given for being in Afghanistan is that we must keep al-Qaeda terrorists from establishing bases there. But, like bin Laden, al-Qaeda left this country years ago and now operates transnationally in Pakistan, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, including England and Germany. Yet, we're told we must continue to pour American lives and dollars into Afghanistan. But why? To create a central, democratically elected government with a 300,000-member army and police force, we're told. But why? To stabilize the country, they say. But why? To keep al-Qaeda out, they repeat, closing the endless loop of a Kafkaesque rationale. This is Jim Hightower saying, President Obama has finally started a slow withdrawal of U.S. troops, but that'll take at least 3 years, more than $300 billion, and untold numbers of shattered lives. The question remains, why?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Something interesting today. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around this. You remember a couple weeks ago there was that whole big, this whole big scene, this whole big production of Eric Cantor storming out of the big debt talks. Made a big deal about it. In fact, we found out later that they had planned it for weeks. That it was, you know, it was a staged thing. They wanted maximum effect. You know, as soon as someone started saying, well, we need to maybe think about raising revenue. They made a big production out of it. And they stormed out, and it was really to appease the idiot doofus base. The people said, no, we can't raise, let it fail, let the country go in, let it go in default, file bankruptcy. Turns out, I had something kind of interesting to say today that just kind of made me think. He said, if the president wants to talk loopholes, we'll be glad to talk loopholes. He said any type of discussion should be coupled with offsetting tax cuts somewhere else. And the question I guess I have, is this the blink that everyone's been looking for? Is this, someone who staged this whole production about we're not going to raise taxes? Because understand, they have been saying for the longest time, if we cut subsidies to the oil companies, if we cut the tax loopholes for the CEOs and their jets, if we take back the gifts we've been giving to Wall Street and these big corporations, that's raising taxes. That's been their frame from the very beginning. Now, as we talked about the other night, I still don't understand how taking back a subsidy from the oil company that was supposed to help them get a start, how that taking back is somehow raising taxes. Nobody's been able to explain that to me. And I think what they're hoping to do is walk back from that, walk away from that position where, maybe we need to start talking about taking back these loopholes, taking back some of the breaks we've been giving out in order to get the massive cuts that we want. There's part of me that's thinking, they got to start softening up their base. They got to start softening up the people they've been firing up and whipping up into a frenzy and getting their panties all in a wad. They've got to figure out how to walk back from those statements. And I think it's kind of interesting, because there's part of me honestly believes that there's a deal already done. And both sides are just trying to figure out how they're going to sell it. I do. I believe there's absolutely a deal already been struck. It's just a matter of how politically you're going to be able to sell each of the very ugly parts to your base. Because I got to be honest with you, I'm not thrilled with the idea of cutting Medicare or Medicaid. And I'm sure the folks in the Tea Party aren't thrilled about taking those subsidies away from BP and those subsidies away from the CEOs. And I'm sure they're very happy, as the Tea Party is, not too bright in the head, very, very, very happy defending the wealth class. So you have to figure out how to soften both sides up. And there's part of me that actually believes that. Because why else would Cantor make that statement? Especially after making that huge production that we know now completely staged. Just one of those things. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this. Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With a PSECU Home Equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, the governor in his budget speech said he wants to be just like Texas. Wants to be just like Texas, you know, because Texas is such a wonderful place. You know, one of the worst places in the country for graduation rates, one of the worst places in the country for education, one of the worst places in the country to be poor, have the highest number of minimum wage jobs in the country. You know, all that good stuff we want to bring right here to Pennsylvania. The largest number of uninsured, you know, the poverty, the highest number of children in poverty, all that stuff. Want to bring it right here home. And the argument is, well, you know, they've done, you know, they've balanced their budgets and they've done all these wonderful conservative things. Well, as you're looking at what they've actually done, they've basically kicked the can down the road even further. They've resulted to accounting gimmicks. They've done some really bizarre stuff, you know, rewriting school funding laws so that they're able to push bills down the road to 2013. They're able to, you know, just really do all of this weird stuff, like finding $800 million by ordering the state accountants to come up with a calculation that grows the property tax value faster than it's actually happening. So they're guessing down the road, and it's you know, it makes me think of Arthur Anderson. What they did is they didn't raise taxes, so that's what Corbett wants to do. They didn't take very much from the rainy day fund. That's what Corbett wanted to do. And they basically kicked the can further down the road for legislature and governors far into the future. Basically what we're doing. So I guess, you know, there's part of me says, you know what? We're just like Texas. And we're heading down that road. You know, we're a state that does pretty well with education. I've got a pretty good graduation rate, testing-wise, do pretty well. Have been going in the right direction for years. I'm waiting to see what this massive budget cut's going to do. I'm waiting to see how this is going to harm kids as we move forward. And again, hey, you know, we're just like Texas, Jake. Aren't you happy? We can be just like Texas.
Yahoo. If only we were like Texas and making sure that, the big companies within our borders, such as in Texas, it's the oil, and here it's the, you know, Marcellus Shale situation. I wish we were more like them in that vein. As long as this governor is governor, I'm not so sure we're going to be like them in that vein anyway, which is one of the few positive things they've done in Texas. They made sure that the oil companies pay their fair share. That's my point.
Yeah, I mean, they actually have an extraction tax. Wow, imagine that. But I guess, you know, hey, you know, if we could have a worse governor, could be the guy in Wisconsin, who it turns out now, some of his donors are accused of breaking campaign finance laws. In fact, the Wisconsin State Insurance Commissioner, a guy named Ted Nickel, and 9 other donors to Scott Walker's campaign, they're being accused of breaking the finance laws. The watchdog group Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, they filed a complaint today with the Government Accountability Board, saying that, you know, these 10 people, they exceeded the maximum $10,000 per period limit. And you look at this guy who's the insurance commissioner. He gave $10,255. And, you know, I kept thinking about this. You know, $10,255. He gave it over three checks. So, you know, there's part of me that goes, you know, maybe he went to one of those failing schools. You know, like Rick Santorum, who couldn't, you know, basically do math. You know, he said, well, the president already created 240 million new jobs. That's 30 million short of the 280 that he promised. Get it? So I can see how you can screw up 10,000 over three. It's not an even number.
I'm just not so sure how you get to 10,255 over 3. That's something that will, I guess, have to be on the test later on. Atlanta Superintendent of Schools, Beverly Hall. They've been having this problem in these right-to-work states and in these southern states with education because they're pretty much all at the bottom. So they've bought into this idea that, you know, these testing models, these charter schools, all of these alternatives, they were going to somehow fix all of the problems. That was going to be the end of it. Well, she said, I expect the investigation, because there's some investigation going on because of cheating in the Atlanta public school system, that they're saying teachers and administrators and people cheated. Raised the test scores of these kids, and she says, you know, when the investigation started, she said it's going to draw some trouble, you know, some troubling, non-alarming conclusions. It's become clear that a segment of our staff chose to violate the trust that was placed in them. Let me be clear, there is simply no excuse for unethical behavior and no room in this district for unethical conduct. Well, the governor, Nathan Deal, today, give out the conclusions of the state's investigation. Turns out 38 principals out of the 70 APS elementary and middle schools were found to be responsible for or directly involved in cheating. 38 of 70. You stop and you think about this. Of the total 178 employees that cheated, 82 of them confessed. 82! Almost half. And you go, exactly where's this whole thing going? Now, you go back and you stop and you think about some of the discussions that went on before we started going to these tests and we started put all this high-pressure stuff going on. The warning signs were there early, and they were there, and they were ignored. And what part of the statement from Deal's office said, a culture of fear, intimidation, and retaliation existed at APS, which created a conspiracy of silence and deniability with respect to the standardized test misconduct. I can't help but recall an extended telephone conversation with Hall last year, in which she took heated umbrage at my description of cheating in her district as pervasive. Turns out, pervasive may have been too kind. Now you look at the system that they've set up. You don't see this in northern schools. You don't see this kind of cheating. You don't see unionized teachers doing this kind of stuff. Because this is fear-based activity. This is the top going down to the bottom and saying, you do this and because your job depends on it. This is what we're in store for here in Pennsylvania if we privatize our education. This is what we're in store for if the Republicans and the Hardy Williams of the world get their way. This is what we're in store for. This kind of nonsense. I mean, this should be criminal. We should be locking those people up. And there's part of me says we should be unionizing. Allowing those teachers who knew it was wrong to say no. But here again, if they say no, there's the door. You have no rights. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Hempstead, New York Mayor Wayne Hall about what's going on over there and his work at helping constituents stay in their homes and avoid foreclosure and what their community is doing to help change the world. We're back after this.
I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Sting is saying, "Don't stand so close to me," to the state oil company of Kazakhstan. The rocker canceled a concert planned in the country to show his solidarity with oil workers who have been on strike. In a statement, the former frontman of The Police said, "Hunger strikes, imprisoned workers, and tens of thousands on strike represents a virtual picket line, which I have no intention of crossing." Sting has long been a supporter of Amnesty International, which is the organization that petitioned Sting to reconsider hosting a concert in the country. The workers have been on strike since May 26th, and Sting had planned to play at a festival celebrating the founding of the country's capital, Astana. Should U.S. labor have a more radical response to the anti-labor movement? Doug Cunningham reports.
Laborers International Union of North America President Terrence O'Sullivan says it's time for a more radical labor movement in light of the strong attacks on fundamental labor rights. O'Sullivan's remarks came during the 125th anniversary of May Day, commemorated in Chicago's Haymarket Square. It was a rededication of the newly restored monument at the grave of the four Haymarket martyrs, executed in 1887 for the Haymarket bombing. That bombing happened during a rally for the eight-hour day.
Just as the men and women of Haymarket stood united and stood fearless in the face of corporate terror, today we must stand united and stand fearless in the face of corporate tyranny. Instead of being at the wrong end of a Pinkerton's baton, working men and women today are at the wrong end of a lawmaker's gavel or a governor's pen. Targets of wealthy special interests who don't want us standing in the way of their greedy agenda. When we're fighting just to hold on to our very lives, there is no movement too radical, and there is no movement too militant.
Yeah. O'Sullivan Audio, courtesy of WORT Radio in Madison.
Michigan has long had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. The last time the state saw a rate not in the double digits was in November of 2008. However, Michigan Republican and House Ways and Means Committee Chair Dave Camp plans to move forward on three free trade agreements Thursday without the consideration of a plan by the Obama administration to extend aid for workers who lose jobs to overseas competition. President Barack Obama has suggested he won't move forward with the trade agreements unless they include the aid for U.S. workers, which expired in February of this year.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Show. You know, since the Bush collapse in September of 08, you know, when Wall Street, the casinos there on Wall Street basically lost the house, what we saw were millions of American workers lose their jobs, millions of them lost their homes, and many millions more saw their homes upside down and underwater. The president, he attempted to, you know, to get these big banks to say, you know what, we're going to reach out, we're going to help people stay in their homes. We're going to do some minimal modifications. And, you know, we'll make sure that, you know, people stay in their homes and we fix this system. But what happened is the banking industry has pretty much ignored their customers, pretty much walked away from that. And we've seen horror stories across the nation that highlight the need for more than what Washington can do. We're seeing groups, community groups, labor groups, cities and towns across this country taking their money from the big banks who are, for all intent and purposes, the cause of the great harm that's happening to our citizens and our communities by not working with their customers. It almost makes no sense to me why they wouldn't. Why they wouldn't work out a plan to keep people in their homes, citizens in their homes, communities stable, and the banks that get their money back. It just doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. The question is, what should we be doing? What should we be doing to fight back against these big banks? Personally, I'm all in favor of putting my money in credit unions. And in the past, we've covered stories of people blocking the doors, the homes being foreclosed on. We've covered stories of families moving into banks after being foreclosed upon, kicked to the curb by the banks. And we've seen citizens pulling their money out of banks because they didn't like their practices. Direct action works. And one of the people on the front lines is Hempstead, New York Mayor Wayne Hall. Mayor Hall, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, as mayor of a small community, you must see firsthand the pain and suffering that this housing crisis has caused and all the foreclosures.
We surely have. You know, Hempstead is the largest village in the state of New York, and unfortunately, we are a minority village, and we have the highest foreclosure rate on Long Island, and possibly, you know, for villages in New York State. So I've seen that. I've seen families being foreclosed on, families that have been paying their rent on time. I mean, not rent, but their mortgage on time, and for being laid off from their job, being in accident, they just can't pay it anymore. And so they asked for a modification. When the bank got in trouble, well, the government bailed them out. So when the regular citizen got in trouble, the bank, gave them such a hard time.
Yeah, I said from the very beginning, we shouldn't have bailed the banks out. We should have bailed the people at the bottom out, bailed the people out, who would then in turn bail the banks out by paying back the mortgages that they owed. This way we have people staying in their homes, we have stable communities, we have banks that are doing all right. It seemed like the right thing to do instead of just saying, here's a whole bunch of money, please don't collapse our economy.
Right, but I really think that they needed to bail the banks out in order for them to stay sovereign. So in that way, but they should have had some kind of stipulation saying that the residents, people who had mortgages should be able to modify their loan.
Yeah, you bring up the fact that your community is one of the largest minority communities there in the state. And what I've heard time and time again from the right, that the minority community and the working poor community have been the ones who've been vilified throughout this whole crisis. And, all I hear is this blame. Well, it's the Community Reinvestment Act. It's the CRA, which, encouraged loans for those people. And I often wonder, what if someone or some movement could organize and harness some of those people, what we could accomplish?
Well, the Community Reinvestment Act, that really doesn't work too well in our community because some of the organizations that are here don't even know about it. What we try to do is get the bank to modify loans. We had a family, and the lady's name was Mary Bell Torrey, who paid her rent, mortgage. It paid her mortgage on time, and it was no problem. And then her husband got laid off, and unfortunately, she got in a car accident. So now there was a limited income coming in. So they really couldn't pay the mortgage on time. Now, considering that they've been paying it on time all along, and Chase just gave them such a hard time.
Well, is this a situation, do you think, that the banks have gotten so large and they're so big and so self-interested that one person doesn't really matter and they're just part of the cog in the wheel and they can be spit out without any thought?
Yeah, but I think that the bank ignores the minority community. Because they realize that people in the minority community don't really, they don't stay together. What we have done here in the village of Hempstead, Community for Change has come to us and asked us if we would start the process of removing our money out of the bank, Chase Bank. And, when I heard it, and they gave me the story and gave me the statistics and everything, and I told them to come to our board meeting, present it to the whole board, and they did. And we unanimously, now we had a Republican and Democrat on the board, unanimously pulled our money out of the bank.
And where did you put it?
At this point right now, we're getting ready to put it in TD Bank because we sent out a request for a proposal and we asked other banks, to give us a proposal, and the bank that gave us the best proposal, it wasn't on one of those predatory lenders or you know, people, banks that don't do modifications, was TD Bank. And that's the bank that we most likely will be leaning to put our $12 million that we pulled out. Now, we on Long Island was the first municipality to pull our money out. We've been talking to other community, Freeport, the legislator up in West White Plains, New York, and asking them to pull their money out. Now, this is how we get the power.
Yep.
The minority community, as you know, divided, don't have any power. But united, we got a lot of power. So we pulled $12 million here, $10 million there, $20 million there, and eventually that adds up to billions of dollars. And once the Chase or whoever, you know, the other predatory lender bank realize that they're losing all that money, then they may see the light.
Well, that's the hope. Have you heard any response? Have you gotten any response from Chase?
I got a response from Chase. They wanted to sit down and talk. They held a seminar at the Marriott Hotel in Uniondale about modifications. I was told that they had one previously in Brooklyn, and they said to the people that came there, every time you hear a bell ring, that's modification taking place. And people told me they sat there for 3-4 hours and never heard a bell. So Chase was giving them a hard time because they were just bullying the minority community. This is our opportunity to show the bank that this power, and if we, you know, like they say, if people united will never be defeated. If we stand together, put all our that power, I think that we can make a difference.
Well, I say that on every issue. You know, I look here in the state of Pennsylvania, the budget that just got rammed through harms only the poor, the elderly, the children, the disabled. That's who it goes after. If we could harness the power of all of those folks, because individually they're all vulnerable, they're all they're the easy targets, they're the easy one to get beat up. But if you can bring them all together into a voting block or into a consumer block, you've got some real power there.
Right. Well, you know, the reason why we get beat up, dumped on, or whatever you want to call it, is because when the politicians look at the numbers of minority people that vote, there's not enough that to make an impact. But they know in the other areas that the majority of the people come out there and vote. But our community, if we got 26,000 people in our village that registered to vote, and in election time, only 4,000 come out to vote. I mean, if I was a politician outside of the village of Hempstead, you know, I'd say, hey, I ain't worried about Hempstead. They don't have any impact. The power of both to bring the attention to politicians and bring the attention of the people that, you know, the banks and everyone else. But unfortunately, our community don't, number one, don't stick together. They don't come out to vote. They don't. It's a tough thing, but I think that if we get the municipalities to pull the money out, that will make a big thing.
Yeah, I mean, because it comes along with small victories. If you do this one thing and people see that it made an impact and it's made folks' lives better, then that's going to get people involved, and it's a snowballing effect. You know, when things start going in the right direction, you'll pull more people in. And the reason I thought this was so important, because this is communities coming together and the kind of organizing that I think people need to see is going on. You know, we went to Wisconsin back in February when the things were going on there. 150,000 people into the streets. This is the way we have to take our country back.
Right, and unfortunately, the GOP is on a mission to protect the rich and forget about the poor people or the middle class. That's not their goal.
Yeah, I
think by doing this, we'll send a message to the big bank. If we can get people to come out to vote, I think we'll send a message to some of the politicians. But, you know, we just got to work on that. It's going to take some time.
You know, I always say there's more of us than there are of them, and why do we keep losing? You know, Warren Buffett says there's class war, and the rich are winning, but they shouldn't be.
Right. So what we got to do is work on people sticking together. We got to work on people coming out to vote. You know, when they say, "Oh, why should I vote? Don't mean anything to me." We have to tell them it does, because many people have sacrificed their life just to vote, and this was recent, almost recent. Back in the 60s, they were dying to vote.
Yep.
So,
and look at how
if
the...
we did all of that, I think that we would be, we can really send a message to the big banks, big businesses, politicians, and I think that we could change the playing field.
I think you're absolutely right. And the reason I know you're right is because I look at how hard the Republicans are working to take that right to vote away from so many in the minority community, so many in the senior citizens community. You just see it all across the country, here in Pennsylvania as well.
Right. They're redistricting here in Nassau County, and they're diluting the minority vote. They have diluted minority district. Put minority districts in super white districts, so that way you have no impact. So this is the GOP. That's their way of operating.
And beyond that, this whole voter ID movement, that they haven't been able to show any significant number of violations or crimes being committed. But boy, we got to spend millions of dollars, you know, to get that here in Pennsylvania. It's been 8 cases in the last decade. We're going to spend $11 million to make sure that those 8 things done by 4 people never happen again.
Well, we here in Hempstead are going to continue, or me personally, will continue on this mission to talk to other municipalities, encourage them to pull their money out of Chase. So then we'll get Chase to sit down and talk to us. And realize that, you know, minority community people have a big voice, and they have an impact on the economy, and especially with the bank. So that's a hard task.
Yep.
But you know what? I am not going to give up on that, because when, like I said, Community for Change came to me and said that this is what they wanted to do, I thought that was a great campaign.
That's a great campaign, and as mayor, it's going to help you stabilize your community by keeping people who want to be in those homes in their homes.
Right, and it's going to send a message to the bank. Hey, you're in a minority community, do the right thing.
Excellent point, Governor. Mayor Hall, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the work you guys are doing there. Keep it up. Look forward to talking to you again.
Hey, I appreciate it. You guys have a great night.
Thanks so much. Hempstead, New York Mayor Wayne Hall. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
America's long, long war in Afghanistan has drained more than 1,500 precious lives and about $500 billion from our country. But finally, this enormous outlay paid off with the capture and killing of that Al-Qaeda demon, Osama bin Laden, who attacked America and was the reason our military went into Afghanistan. Oh, wait. Osama wasn't in Afghanistan, was he? He was comfortably ensconced in Pakistan, whose leaders are supposedly our allies. And it wasn't the costly Afghan war effort that got bin Laden. It was old-time spy work, culminating in a raid involving a small team of Navy SEALs, a dog, and 2 helicopters. So why have 2 presidents and a decade of Congresses dumped so many lives and so much money into a country that poses no threat to us? Hardly a powerhouse, Afghanistan is an impoverished, anarchic, largely illiterate land of ancient tribal factions and fractious warlord fiefdoms. They have no desire or ability to attack us. The only reason we're given for being in Afghanistan is that we must keep Al-Qaeda terrorists from establishing bases there. But, like bin Laden, Al-Qaeda left this country years ago and now operates transnationally in Pakistan, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, including England and Germany.
Yet, we're told we must continue to pour American lives and dollars into Afghanistan. But why? To create a central, democratically elected government with a 300,000-member army and police force, we're told. But why? To stabilize the country, they say. But why? To keep al-Qaeda out, they repeat, closing the endless loop of a Kafkaesque rationale. This is Jim Hightower saying, President Obama has finally started a slow withdrawal of U.S. troops, but that'll take at least 3 years, more than $300 billion, and untold numbers of shattered lives. The question remains, why?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
It's an interesting conversation I had with Mayor Hall. You know, I look at that and I say, you know, more communities should be helping their citizens. That's what local government's supposed to be doing. They should be going to the banks, going to bat for their constituents. That's part of what they're supposed to do. That's part of why they're there. And there's part of me that says, maybe we're not seeing this happening as often as it is, or maybe we should be seeing more of it. I look at. The reality is, if we keep people in their homes who want to be there, but they've just hit a bump in the road, it's better for the communities. It's better than having a whole bunch of empty places that are going to fall down, and the value of those homes continue to fall, and then dragging everybody else with them. That's the simple answer there. The question is, how do we get back from that? But there are people out there doing a lot of organizing, and I look at this group, New York Communities for Change, who are doing some of this work. One of their board members, Gene Shenang, is here to talk to us. Gene, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing at New York Communities for Change.
Oh, well, what we're doing is that some months ago, we did a study and found that, six percent of the people who asked Chase for help with their mortgages, only 6% got any kind of help at all.
Wow, that's not a very high number.
No, it's not. So that's 94% who are still looking at getting evicted or getting foreclosed on.
How does that compare with the other banks?
It seems par for the course. I heard one success story out of Hempstead. Mayor, the mayor mentioned it. One woman actually got some help with her house, but that's one person out of everyone in Hempstead who was looking, you know, to get help. So, and that's with the mayor, you know, backing her up and with us organizing. So, Bank of America, we hear a lot come up, and, you know, that's a lot of fall out of Countrywide. And, Wells Fargo, the big six are pretty much, you know, on par with each other.
So it's an industry thing. It's not just Chase. It's pretty much all of them. It's the structure that you're against. So this is not just one bank. It's a movement that you're going to have to get all of them moving on. I've got to be honest, after the collapse of 2008, I said what should have happened is you should have broken up those big banks, made them smaller regional or smaller local community banks. This way, people who are having trouble can go to the local bank and say, I'm having trouble, and sit down with somebody right there instead of a recording at the end of an answering machine and playing that game.
Well, I don't want to digress, but, you know, your smaller banks and your credit unions didn't melt down.
They didn't what?
You know, I mean, credit unions didn't join the mortgage as securities game, and so a lot of your credit unions did fine.
I mean, they actually followed the rules instead of becoming gambling houses and setting up these interesting gambles, these interesting bets that we all lost on. That's an excellent point. Let's talk about your personal story. I understand that you yourself and your family fighting to keep your home. Can you explain a little bit of your background there?
Sure. All right. Pretty briefly, and my story is not a unique one. About 3 years ago, I was laid off from my job as my wife was scheduled to undergo surgery. So we had to make a choice between the mortgage or health insurance, right? And so
that's
we decided
no-brainer.
On health insurance to keep the surgery covered.
Right.
So from then, I asked, you know, we called Chase out just at the beginning of it, so people in the retail branches didn't know what a modification was. They kept talking about refinancing. And from there, I managed to hook up with NYCC, who got me counseling with the Mutual Housing Association of New York. And so my counselor and I put together a package for Chase so I could keep paying and staying in my home, you know.
It's not that you, weren't going to pay anything. It's not that you didn't want to pay.
Right, not charity. We're just looking to, you know, maybe reduce the profit margin. You know, just keep us in our home of, so that it works for everybody. You know, I stay a customer. I stay in my home. I keep paying property taxes, and Chase makes something out of the deal. You know, that's besides the point that, you know, that they're insured and covered, for any losses that they get in their mortgage in their mortgage outlets anyway. But
well, let me ask you this, Gene. Let me ask you this. You know, in looking at this, because you brought up pretty much the point, and the point is that the banks are insured. By taking your house, they're going to get their money back. Plus, they're going to have a property to sell. So they're making hay on this both ways.
Yeah.
So there's really no incentive for them to help you to modify your loan. There's really no incentive for them at all.
Well, there's no short-term profit in modifying in keeping people in their home.
Now, I would say that the short-term profit is in getting you out of your home so that they can get the insurance money plus have a property to sell.
Well, it doesn't happen right away, but you know, they get people out of their homes and then they stockpile the property until, you know, I mean, that's my theory. There are different theories about why they keep warehousing all these homes, and, you know, neighbors like mine keep having shuttered homes on the block, bringing everyone's property values down. But, you know, my thought is that they're going to warehouse all these properties until the market decides to come back, and then they're going to make that auction bonus on top of their securities insurance and their write-off.
Yep. Amazing stuff. Look, explain to me real quick, because I think people might not know. What's the difference between a modification and a refi?
Okay, so a refi is where you go to get, I guess, change in your terms, but it's really a brand new mortgage. And you're paying brand new appraisal fees. You're paying brand new court fees and lawyer office rentals and processing charges and everything else the bank can find to throw on top of it.
Title insurance and all of that stuff, right.
Right. So you're paying all that brand. So it's really a brand new loan, but just call it refinance because it's just you and it's still you talking about the same house. A modification is where the bank that has the note, and that's a whole other story, show me the note.
If they have it,
the bank that has the note changes does the changes on your present mortgage to either, and what New York City Community for Change is looking for is a reduction in principal to the actual amount the house is worth now, a reduction in interest and terms to something, you know, affordable, you know, like 2% permanent, 2% interest permanently. And so a modification is a changing of your present mortgage to just dropping the interest rate and or possibly dropping the principal, the original loan amount.
And what kind of, are you getting any success with the, with this package?
With my package?
Yeah, I mean with the whole movement. I mean, you said New York Communities for Change. That's the kind of package that they're pushing through. Are we seeing?
That's what we want, right.
Yeah,
so,
are you seeing success?
Unfortunately, like my story, so ever since we put my package in, my proposal in, it's just been the runaround of expired documents. You know, they don't respond until your documents are expired, and they want new documents, they want new W-2s, new unemployment papers, new tax authorizations, and they just keep you on the spinning wheel, and you're supposed to be paying the mortgage that you can't afford in the meantime. So what this campaign is about, and the reason we focus on Chase is because we're New York State. We have our members of New York State. And so Chase is number three in the country, but it's based in New York. They're high profile in New York. They have a very supposedly consumer-friendly image. And so what we want to do is have, if we make Goliath fall in line and do the right thing, then Bank of America will see that coming and fall in line. And Wells Fargo and HSBC and everybody else will, you know, as Chase goes, the rest of the industry goes.
Yeah. Well, I wish you guys nothing but the best of luck. You guys over at New York Communities for Change, I think what you're doing is a great thing. And again, as I've said from the beginning, you keep people in their homes, stabilizes communities. That can only be a good thing.
Right, but don't make no mistake. This thing is catching on. It's really moving forward. We've already got three major governments that have already withdrawn, closed their government accounts with Chase. You know, and you just spoke to the mayor of Hempstead. We've got Freeport that just voted to close their accounts. We've got Albany County right ready to close, and the city of Albany is about to vote a resolution to do. It doesn't target Chase directly, but whoever is not modifying mortgages in their city will have their government accounts closed.
No, that's the kind of thing that has to happen.
That's right.
And that's what it's called, direct action, and I'm in favor of it. Gene, I appreciate the time. I wish you nothing but the best of luck. You guys keep up the great work.
All right, thank you.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Steve Raisley, United Steelworker labor activist, about these trade agreements. Just got me nuts here. Back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make wrestling happen!
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Again, I go back to this. You know, this is what the Democrats are doing, and you know, a number of the Republicans on these trade deals. You know, I look at, again, you know, why put Max Baucus in charge of anything? He is the Senate Finance Committee chairman, but still, he's saying on Thursday they're gonna start action moving the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, the South Korean Free Trade Agreement, and the Panamanian Free Trade Agreement through, pushing this. Now there's part of me that says, you know, the poker game of this, the president is throwing this trade adjustment assistance out there to make sure that it doesn't happen. But part of me says, you know, he's just on board with the rest of them. They've all drank the tea. They've all got the Kool-Aid in them, and this free trade seems to be their belief structure. And I wish someone would stand up and say, you know what, free trade sucks. It's killing this country. It is destroying American jobs. That's just amazing stuff. I've got Steve Raisley. He's a United Steelworkers labor activist. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, I appreciate being here. Thank you.
You know, I look at these trade agreements, and, you know, none of them have ever worked out well for the American worker. They've screwed every one of the people who get their hands dirty, but they've done very well for the investor class.
That's a fact.
So, you know, when I look at this stuff, again, you know, you go back and who are the winners, who are the losers? The winners are going to be Wall Street and the big agribusiness owners, and the losers are going to be people like you and me.
That's exactly right. That's the way it's always has been ever since Clinton signed NAFTA. And it just continues to deteriorate the manufacturing abilities of the United States, our men and women workers.
You know, why can't we get this through our heads? It's not working. We're getting our lunch. You know, I don't mind trading with countries like Germany, with countries like the UK. I don't mind, you know, trading with Canada. I got a problem with China, India, Pakistan, you know, all of the developing world. We should not be having free trade agreements with these countries.
Well, you know, free trade with these guys go a whole lot further than, you know, just free trade. I mean, you're talking about violations of workers' rights, child labor, environmental controls, safety. You know, it's just a mess. And, you know, we continue buying from these people. You know, it's a never-ending circle. And now, you know, Colombia and as well as Panama and Korea were signed some time ago. You know, it just hasn't been put into effect yet. We also have permanent national trade relations with China. And, you know, for instance, every 52 cars right now, Rick, that we send to Korea or that they send to the United States, we send one to them.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's no way to run a country. And we wonder why we don't have jobs.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, the steelworkers, we have a heck of a program with steelworkers, as well as a lot of other unions too, but we have a rapid response program where we go out and we try to educate our people, and we do a great job in that all over the country. And I'm in District 10 in Pennsylvania, and we have a great program where we keep our people educated. We send letters, we lobby. In fact, if I could say, you know, we're part of the biggest special interest groups in the United States, the men and women who work for a living. But nobody listens to the special interest group. You know, everybody listens to the special interest groups that have a lot of money to donate to their campaigns so they continue to run for election.
Yeah, and here's the thing that gets me. You know, we've got a president who the radical right is saying is kowtowing to big labor at every turn, yet today they opened up the Mexican border. Mexican trucks are going to be rolling across the border any day now. So I don't know how that's pandering to big labor. These trade agreements, only one union that I know of has come out in favor of the South Korean, and nobody's come out in favor of the other ones. I don't know how that's pandering to big labor, but that's the frame the radical right keeps pushing out. And I think some working people have actually bought into.
I think a lot of working people have actually bought into that too, Rick. That's the reason we had such a bad time with this. Several years ago, we had a congressman in the 8th Congressional District, Mike Kirkpatrick, who was the congressman at that time. and we were voting on CAFTA. This was like 7 or 8 years ago. And I sat in his office with a bunch of working people, a bunch of steel workers, and we talked about persuading him to vote against CAFTA. He sat right there, and he told 7 or 8 of us that I should watch his vote that night and count it. Well, I watched it, and I counted it. And he and my congressman in the 15th Congressional District voted for CAFTA. We lost that vote by 2 people, by 2 votes. Following 2 terms, he got beat by Patrick Murphy. And what happens? The people forget. They come back and they put this guy back in office again to do the same thing he did before, vote against working men and women and their jobs in manufacturing.
And, you know, you stop and you look at – and I talk about my grandfather, his generation – you know, he came back from World War II, you know, worked in factories, drove a truck, made a very good middle-class existence. He understood. He got it that, you know, we have to have jobs here. We have to protect our investments here. And, you know, I remember the whole 80s thing, him talking about we're giving away all of our wealth. We're giving away these jobs. This country's going down because we're giving away our productive capacity.
Absolutely. You remember when NAFTA got passed, Congressman and Senator said the only thing you're going to see going out of this country is a giant sucking sound of all our jobs leaving this country.
Now, that was actually Ross Perot. He was a presidential candidate at the time saying, you know what, it's a giant sucking sound. And he was right.
Yep.
I mean, it is. It's what we've saw. It's what we saw with NAFTA. In fact, you know, I often talked about the Chevy Suburban. One was made in Mexico. One was made in Janesville, Wisconsin. When they sat on the lot, the only thing different about them were their VIN plates, but they cost the same.
Absolutely.
And now they don't even make that in Janesville, Wisconsin anymore because they closed that plant down.
No. Free trade's great in theory, but in practice it hasn't been fair to American workers. It never will be.
Yeah, and this whole concept, the whole idea that somehow it's going to raise all boats hasn't happened. What it's done is it's pulled us all down.
Oh, I'm telling you, you know, we're not talking thousands of jobs we've lost over the last couple of decades. We're talking millions of jobs. And we're not talking about jobs that, you know, in the service industries. We're talking about good manufacturing jobs with good benefits where you could raise your family, send your kids to college, and go on vacation a week or two a year. No more.
Well, it's become, and now it's a political football almost. They're saying that these job loss all because of the unions and all because, you know, of Obama. You know, I guess Romney was just in Allentown recently, and the Allentown Metalworks place was going out of business and has been for a while. He used that as a prop.
Absolutely. I happened to be involved in that. I was the servicing representative for those folks at our local 2599-32. And he came into town, and of course he said, take a look at Allentown Metalworks. This was a plant that the president had visited when he was running for election, and that the only thing that his economic policies did was close this plant. And I was asked to speak on that, which I did, and I'm not sure if economic policies closed that plant or not. I'm sure his didn't. I'm sure President Bush's might have had something to do with that. Any economic policies that the president wanted to put into effect was stalled and continue to be stalled to a great extent by our do-nothing Congress. And, of course, trade agreements, that's a metal plant, that's a steelworker plant, and they produce different steel products. Free trade cost them that plant.
Well, it cost us the entire industry.
Absolutely.
That and the fact that you had steel mills that they decided to buy golf courses and hotels instead of reinvesting in their business like Bethlehem Steel did.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I go over to our event, Bittner Hall in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania now, and I look at that. They used to have 30,000 members over there, and it's a travesty. You know, we still got a bunch of steelworkers here in the Lehigh Valley. We still have a bunch of steelworkers, maybe 60, 70,000 in the state of Pennsylvania. But we had a heck of a lot more than that before, you know, free trade took over the horizon.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Anytime you start talking about, you know, scaling back this idea of free trade, of unfettered access to markets, this laissez-faire nonsense, anytime you start talking about, you know, maybe taking a second look, you get labeled a protectionist or an isolationist.
Yeah.
And I say, I'm a protectionist.
Absolutely.
When I leave my house at night, I lock the door.
Absolutely.
I'm not an isolationist, though. You know, I didn't dig a moat around my house. I do believe in participating with others when it benefits me and others. I think that's the way to go.
Absolutely. But you tell me, Rick, and I know I'm preaching to the choir when I speak to you. Who is going to buy something from us? Somebody going to buy a Ford or a Cadillac from us from Colombia or Panama? I doubt that very much.
Or from South Korea, for that matter.
Or from South Korea.
And what bothers me about the trade agreement, if you really get into the South Korean one, you know, they've got this domestic content rule of 35%. So an American car going to South Korea has to have 35% American content. Does that mean 65% of it can be Chinese? And
obviously.
Does that mean, so coming from South Korea, it can be 65% Chinese, 35% South Korea coming into the U.S.?
Sure. You know, just a little while ago, you talked about people forgetting, people not doing the right thing. You know, who did we elect as senator last year? Pat Toomey. He used to be my congressman, too, here in the 15th Congressional District. Fortunately for us, he decided he wouldn't run again because of term limits. But he's back on the horizon. He's back as a U.S. senator in the state of Pennsylvania, and he does nothing but love free trade agreements. I don't think he's ever seen one that he didn't love.
And again, why do people, and I bash my head over this, you know, why do people vote for folks who, one, don't believe in government, and two, don't believe in protecting what's yours? I mean, or I guess what's yours, not what's theirs. Yeah. I guess that's the answer.
Yeah, you're right, Rick. I mean, you know, we bang our heads against the wall, I guess. But guys like me and you, guys like the steel workers, guys like other unions in this country are going to continue to do it until we get it right. Hopefully we will.
And I saw the steelworkers had a great victory this past week. I saw a press release come out that, you know, the WTO found that China has been illegally constraining exports of raw materials, something
Absolutely.
That the steelworkers did.
Absolutely. You know, we're in the forefront of things like that. We're on it all the time. It was a great victory for not only the steelworkers. You know, it was a great worker victory for anybody who works for a living in that industry. You know, for instance, you know, you talk about the auto industry. We have a lot of members in the auto industry. We do a lot of things in the auto industry. You know, we have a lot of things go into cars, and we make a lot of them.
Carpeting, windows, all of that stuff. But what bothers me here is the fact that the steelworkers had to do it. Why aren't businesses filing these? Why aren't local governments? Why isn't our government doing this? Why does it have to be the working people, the people that are getting screwed by this? Why are they the ones who have to fight this fight?
Rick, I guess we're the only ones who will do it. We're the only ones who don't have any axe to grind with anybody. All we want is to get a fair shake, get a good living wage, and be able to raise our families. So we got no choice but to do it. I mean, you know, they're attacking Social Security. They're attacking Medicare. They're attacking everything across the board here, you know, and they're taking our jobs from us on top of it. I don't know how we're going to survive.
Well, we're going to survive by having folks like you out there fighting for us and us ourselves getting out in the streets and taking to the message as well.
I appreciate that, brother.
Steve, I appreciate the time. Great talking to you. I'd love to have you back again.
Anytime. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it when you're happy.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Remember
Proving that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there for your convenience, your entertainment as well. You know, you look at this stuff, and it's one of those moments.
Light bulb.
You know, it's got to dawn on you at some point that, you know, we're getting screwed in all this. You look at the fact that it was the steel workers who had to take this this 301 case, to the World Trade Organization and say, look, the Chinese are restricting exports of rare earth minerals. We cannot compete. I understand the Chinese going, no, it's ours. We're not going to freely trade it. But that's the agreement. And it's only the steel workers. Our government isn't doing it because we've bought into this whole, well, we need to have China and we need to have these things because our companies want it. And understand that the majority of trade, and this is something that most people don't talk about, the majority of trade between the Chinese and the U.S., you know, what's coming between China and the U.S., are just companies trading with themselves. GE trading with GE China and GE America. Intra-corporate trading. You know, it isn't like Chinese companies are building products, sending it over, and we're trading with products. No. We've got American companies over there pairing with Chinese firms, making stuff that we used to make here, bringing it back. And we're buying it. And I think there was an article today by a guy named Alan Tollinson, who wrote this article, and I think it raises a bunch of interesting points and questions. He's the author of the book Race to the Bottom. He's also a research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council. He points out that Obama's new program to revive American manufacturing, and the whole idea is more federal money for university research and federal research. You know, he says it's promising. You know, it's probably a good idea. Problem is it's way too small. And it's kind of what I've been saying all along. What we need is big. We need chunky. We need gigantic. We need to build something huge. Or like Lewis Black says, a freaking big thing. But what he says is what Obama's plan does is it ignores the structural and global challenges. Mainly responsible for domestic industries malaise, you know, the problems that we're having. And he says, in a word, quote, imports keep corroding what had been a powerful engine of job creation, growth, and technological progress. And I have this bell moment. It's one of those, you know,
light bulb.
Yeah, protection. Protect yourself. Yes, it's the engine of job creation, growth, progress. Having domestic industry, wow. And he points out something that I think even a teabag Republican can grasp. He says one way to grasp the scale that, you know, this mismatch between the Obama plan and the plight of domestic manufacturing, the president's proposal would devote $500 million annually in federal and private sector funding. $500 million to promote advanced manufacturing. The idea of saying, okay, we're going to give out this $500 million to people who are starting new factories and have innovative new ideas. We're going to be that thing that we were in the 60s and 70s. The problem is, and he points this out, and again, it's that scale thing again. The problem is the manufacturing trade deficit, you know, the stuff that we buy from everywhere else in excess of what we export is almost $600 billion. It's nowhere even close to the amount that we need. And he, you know, he points out that, you know, most people have this idea in their head that manufacturing is just crumbling. That, well, that's just Rust Belt industry that just went overseas and they couldn't compete because they were bloated and lazy and they had unions and all of this stuff. But he says, no, hold on. The reality is, and his organization did a study, shows that more than 100 of America's most advanced manufacturing industries, you know, the semiconductor production places, the electromedical device places, the pharmaceuticals, construction equipment, you know, you name it, you know, turbines and turbine generators and all kind of stuff. They've lost their market share because of imports. And why have they lost their market share because of imports? Because most of the time you've got governments that subsidize. Most of the time you've got American companies that are moving over there to lower their costs. He writes, in fact, nearly a fourth of the industry studied includes several machine tool-related categories, broadcast and wireless telecommunications equipment and turbines and turbine generator sets. They lost more than half of their market to imports in 2009. Lost more than half. And why is that? Well, it's because all of these imports keep coming in, and we've opened our doors and say, yes, bring it in. Bring it all in, yes, fill our shelves. And the Walmarts of the world say, hey, when are you going to China? And hey, you know, we need that cheaper. So we're basically undercutting our industrial base. And he writes, strangely, the main culprits in this saga include not only foreign governments that have long rigged global manufacturing markets with impunity, they also include American companies that for decades have followed the offshore mantra. Manufacture and even innovate in low cost, light regulation, often heavy subsidized foreign production bases, and then import back. The marvel is not the U.S. companies do it. The surprise is that our trade policy so often actually encourages them to do it. Stop and think about that for a second. Not that the companies are doing it. I'm not surprised about that, and neither is he. What I'm surprised at is that we, in our tax code, actually reward them for doing it. What is wrong with us? So he finishes up by saying, look, the president's measures, you know, they may help, but they're not going to fix our problems until we fix the fundamental flaw that is our trade policy. And basically, I mean, he reiterates everything that I've been saying for the longest time. You know, if I leave my door wide open, am I surprised when I come home and there's nothing left? No. The fact that we have failed to invest in research and development, the fact that we have failed to invest in this country, in fact, if actually giving people an incentive to leave, is it surprising that they left? No. Which is why at some point we need somebody with the stones to stand up and close the door. It's that simple, Jake. We need someone to eventually wake up and say, these trade agreements got to stop.
I mean, we have a horrendous record. And now we have a Congress who actually is going to pass. They're going to pass the Korean Free Trade Agreement, which by itself is going to eliminate almost 160,000 jobs more just in the Korean Free Trade Agreement. 160,000 more. Not to mention the fact that we're getting killed on a ratio. Who would ever agree to those numbers? I mean,
are we
taking it on? It's unbelievable. I mean, come on. This is just common sense.
Yeah. When are we going to get Congress to have that
light bulb?
When are we going to have that light bulb moment? When are they going to wake up? Amazing stuff to me. And you know. You know, I remember when I interviewed Hillary Clinton when she was running for president, and I asked her, so what are we going to do about China? You know, they're eating our lunch. And she was right then. She said, don't blame China. Blame us. We're the ones who let it happen. We're to blame. They're not doing anything to us that we aren't encouraging and allowing. And we've got to stop it.
Thank you. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Sting is saying, "Don't stand so close to me," to the State Oil Company of Kazakhstan. The rocker canceled a concert planned in the country to show his solidarity with oil workers who have been on strike. In a statement, the former frontman of The Police said, "Hunger strikes, imprisoned workers, and tens of thousands on strike represents a virtual picket line, which I have no intention of crossing." Sting has long been a supporter of Amnesty International, which is the organization that petitioned Sting to reconsider hosting a concert in the country. The workers have been on strike since May 26th, and Sting had planned to play at a festival celebrating the founding of the country's capital, Astana. Should U.S. labor have a more radical response to the anti-labor movement? Doug Cunningham reports.
Laborers International Union of North America President Terrence O'Sullivan says it's time for a more radical labor movement in light of the strong attacks on fundamental labor rights. O'Sullivan's remarks came during the 125th anniversary of May Day, commemorated in Chicago's Haymarket Square. It was a rededication of the newly restored monument at the grave of the four Haymarket martyrs, executed in 1887 for the Haymarket bombing. That bombing happened during a rally for the eight-hour day.
Just as the men and women of Haymarket stood united and stood fearless in the face of corporate terror, today we must stand united and stand fearless in the face of corporate tyranny. Instead of being at the wrong end of a Pinkerton's baton, working men and women today are at the wrong end of a lawmaker's gavel or a governor's pen. Targets of wealthy special interests who don't want us standing in the way of their greedy agenda. When we're fighting just to hold on to our very lives, there is no movement too radical and there is no movement too militant.
O'Sullivan audio courtesy of WORT Radio in Madison.
Michigan has long had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. The last time the state saw a rate not in the double digits was in November of 2008. However, Michigan Republican and House Ways and Means Committee Chair Dave Camp plans to move forward on three free trade agreements Thursday without the consideration of a plan by the Obama administration to extend aid for workers who lose jobs to overseas competition. President Barack Obama has suggested he won't move forward with the trade agreements unless they include the aid for U.S. workers, which expired in February of this year.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Last night we talked about this story out in California with BMW and the fact that they decided that they didn't want to be in the business of being a distribution warehouse anymore, so they were going to outsource all these jobs to a third-party logistics corporation and basically dump all of their workers. Say, sorry, thanks for the 30-plus years. Thanks for your dedication. Thanks for those missed baseball games. Thanks for, the weekends and nights and all that. Thanks, but goodbye. And I said, basically what this is the evisceration. This is the end of the middle class. And we absolutely need labor law reform. We need something to protect workers from these type of employers. But what you find out from this story is that the workers are actually fighting back. And that's why I've asked their business representative, Secretary Treasurer of Local 495, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Bob Lennox, to come talk to us about this story and the fight that's going on. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rick. I really appreciate the opportunity to tell their story.
I look at this, and again, you see this happen in other places, and it just happens because the workers aren't organized. They don't have representation. For me, the very first thing out of the box, I look at this story, and I go, you got 71 people who are a group, a community, a collective group willing to fight back.
Oh, that's absolutely right, and you know, really beyond that, they've really got 1.4 million Teamster members standing behind them. We just had our Teamster convention in Las Vegas last week, and I put a motion on the floor Thursday afternoon, and I asked all the there were about 1,600 delegates at the convention. I asked the delegates to sign pledges to commit to handling BMW dealers around the country, and we got a little over 1,300 signed commitments by delegates who represent their local unions from around the country to go out, and we're going to be kicking that off big time next weekend.
Well, anything we can do to help, we would be more than happy to, because it's this kind of stuff that has to be fought back. And, you know, I look at this, and for me, you know, these are dedicated workers. These are people who spent their lives building this company, making them very profitable. And this company is very profitable from what I've read, correct?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, their 2011 first quarter earnings were $1.78 billion, which represented a 21% increase from their first quarter sales from last year.
And over last year, they had $4.7 billion in profit the entire year last year. And now they're telling their workforce, sorry, we don't want to do this anymore.
That's right. And it came out of the sky, out of nowhere. I mean, our reps went down to meet with management. Management asked for a meeting. We assumed that it was to talk about some preliminary discussions about health care costs and what the focus of the bargaining was going to be. And they dropped the bomb and said that there weren't going to be any difficult negotiations. And in fact, they called the meeting to notify the union that they intended to terminate all of the employees on the expiration date, August 31, and the next day bring in a third party outsourced group to perform their jobs.
And not even offer those people those jobs or pick up the workers or the contract. Just sorry, hey, thanks for the years. There's the door.
As far as the contract goes, they're saying no. As far as the workers go, they've made statements to the press that they it's up to the third-party contractor whether they offer them any positions or allow them to apply for their jobs.
And
whatever those terms and conditions would be between the contractor and the employee.
I would be interested to see what the wage of that job would be compared to what those workers are making right now and how, again, you're seeing a theft from the middle class, the wealth of the middle class being redistributed. And I love that term because the teabaggers in this area, that's all they scream about. Oh, you want to redistribute wealth. And I look at a situation like this. This is a redistribution of wealth.
Absolutely, Rick. And that's what's going on around the country. We're seeing it everywhere and on a much bigger scale than this. But the redistribution is exactly that, the money going all to the top. And we're going to return to this trickle-down concept, but on a much larger scale than we've ever seen before.
The elected officials out in that area, your senators, your congresspeople, what are they doing? I know the article said that they wrote, quote, a painfully polite letter to the CEO of BMW. What are they doing to help?
Now, that was a characterization by the reporter, but we had the letters sent by California Senator Barbara Boxer, and also the congressman from that district, Joe Baca, who's been a historic, really strong Teamster supporter. We've supported him. He's got a very strong labor record. So does Barbara Boxer. Boxer's office had a 45-minute conversation with three BMW executives last Friday. And they were pressuring BMW to try to reconsider this decision. And they got into what was the cost savings going to be. And they could not tell Boxer's office, her aides, what the savings was going to be. They didn't know.
They couldn't or wouldn't?
They couldn't, they claim. They claim also they don't know who the third party will be, which seems awfully disingenuous on their part. Here we are less than 60 days from the plant closing, if you want to call it that, and they don't know who's going to run it.
Yeah, that's not a way a German company ever runs, from my understanding.
No, not since World War II.
But what I do know is evidently we gave them $3.6 billion in loans after the great Bush collapse of 2008.
Right. They got special low-interest loans that weren't available to any company through a special Federal Reserve program. When private capital was frozen at all the banks, they did get $3.6 billion. That's a matter of public record. And, you know, they tried to say they did, but they didn't. they got. They say it's all been paid back. But, you know, when they asked for money when they needed it, the U.S. taxpayers stepped up and gave it to them. Here they repay the taxpayers really with the insult and slap in the face, not only to their workforce, but by throwing these workers on the unemployment line, that's going to cost taxpayers money. We're going to see a lot of home foreclosures. We're going to see a lot of people on relief. We're going to see a lot of horrific things come out of this, which are completely uncalled for. I really think BMW needs to step up to the plate and do the right thing here. It, you know, they've benefited from these employees and growing their market share over the past 40 years tremendously here in the United States. They're now ranked number one in the luxury car market here in the U.S. And to do this to their employees is unconscionable.
I agree. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Lennox, International Brotherhood of Teamsters Secretary Treasurer from Local 495 out in California. You know, Bob, you know, I've been seeing a lot of unions, especially the steel workers, reaching out internationally, and the communications worker union working out, you know, striking out internationally, reaching out to the unions in Germany and across the globe, saying, you know, we need to work together. Have you done any of this in this situation? Reached out to the German unions and said, hey, look, this is what BMW is doing here in the United States, because I know this would never fly there in Germany. Have you had any of that contact?
Yes. In fact, the corporate campaign department, the staff there, they have been in contact with the IG Metal Workers Union, which is the German equivalent of the United Auto Workers, and we're soliciting their support. We do have the support of the ILA in New Jersey, as well as the UAW distribution center right there in Pennsylvania. We're also talking to the International Longshoremen Association about unloading of those ships, both in New Jersey and in the port of Port Minami in California. And we do have the support of the English equivalent of the auto workers, and we were in discussions with them today about some job actions and other things that are going to happen. So, yes, yeah, you're absolutely right. We have to have these companies are all global. I mean, they don't even consider themselves. Forget, well, this is BMW. It's a foreign company. But even the U.S. companies, they don't even consider themselves the equivalent of an American company anymore. They're all multinationals or global conglomerates. They have no loyalty to anybody. The only thing they're loyal to is the buck.
That's it. To the bottom line. And, you know, I guess the argument... The argument then becomes, you know, as the article points out, well, gee, you know, it's like the mafia. Nothing personal. It's just how things are. And I say, well, if that's just things are, how are they are, I don't think I want that to be the way they are. I think we should be changing them, which, again, you look at this scenario and it highlights the need for labor law reform in the worst way in this country.
Yeah. Well, I think when the country has always been at its most prosperous, it's been when there's been a balance between labor and management and the public interest. And in the era that we live in now, I mean, it was really the last 10 years, in particular under the Bush era, it really got out of whack. But then now with the Tea Party control of the Republican Party, all sensibilities have flown out the window. And you've seen an absolute declaration of war on unions, both private and public sector. They're starting in the public sector, but they're coming after the private sector. In fact, like you said, they've been hollowing out the private sector for years with outsourcing. That's one thing. It's horrible enough outsourcing American jobs overseas in the name of global competition, as they call it. It's another thing to outsource the very same jobs right here at home, right in the same building.
Yeah, I mean, look what we did today. We opened up the Mexican border to long-haul trucks. So you're going to destroy what's left of the trucking industry in this country by lowering the wages and destroying the working conditions even worse. But here again, as you've said, it's worse when you're outsourcing in your own country. And, you know, I guess my last question I have for you is, what can we do to fight back against this kind of stuff? Because we are seeing it across the country. We're seeing corporations who think that, especially foreign corporations who are good to their own employees in their own countries, the IKEA down here in Virginia, another perfect example of that, who they're in their country, they're good, decent, upstanding employers. They come here to the U.S. and boy, it's open season on abusing workers.
Yep. That's the beauty of America. Free to do whatever you want, including screw everybody. But, yeah, I think the best thing the public could do would be to call or write BMW headquarters in New Jersey and ask them to stop this insanity, that they need to step up to the plate and support these workers that have been loyal BMW employees and do the right thing. That's what we're asking them to do.
Bob, I appreciate your time. When you guys win this, I want to have you back to talk about the victory, because I think this is the front lines of the class war, brother, and we're wishing you nothing but the best.
Thank you so much, Rick, and thank your listeners for listening.
Thanks so much, Bob. Bob Lennox, IBT Secretary Treasurer of Local 495. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
America's long, long war in Afghanistan has drained more than 1,500 precious lives and about $500 billion from our country. But finally, this enormous outlay paid off with the capture and killing of that Al-Qaeda demon, Osama bin Laden, who attacked America and was the reason our military went into Afghanistan. Oh, wait. Osama wasn't in Afghanistan, was he? He was comfortably ensconced in Pakistan, whose leaders are supposedly our allies. And it wasn't the costly Afghan war effort that got bin Laden. It was old-time spy work, culminating in a raid involving a small team of Navy SEALs, a dog, and two helicopters. So why have two presidents and a decade of Congresses dumped so many lives and so much money into a country that poses no threat to us? Hardly a powerhouse, Afghanistan is an impoverished, anarchic, largely illiterate land of ancient tribal factions and fractious warlord fiefdoms. They have no desire or ability to attack us. The only reason we're given for being in Afghanistan is that we must keep Al-Qaeda terrorists from establishing bases there. But, like bin Laden, Al-Qaeda left this country years ago and now operates transnationally in Pakistan, Yemen, Uzbekistan, and elsewhere, including England and Germany. Yet, we're told we must continue to pour American lives and dollars into Afghanistan. But why? To create a central, democratically elected government with a 300,000-member army and police force, we're told. But why? To stabilize the country, they say. But why? To keep Al-Qaeda out, they repeat, closing the endless loop of a Kafkaesque rationale. This is Jim Hightower saying, President Obama has finally started a slow withdrawal of U.S. troops, but that'll take at least 3 years, more than $300 billion, and untold numbers of shattered lives. The question remains, why?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love?
Hugging them, maybe reach into their wallet and grab their wallet out from their pocket. Because I got to tell you, I'm looking at the money that these guys are raising, and it is just obscene. The Republican Governors Association reported today that it has raised $21.1 million in the first half of this year. They have eclipsed the six-month total pretty much from 2007 to 2009. They've erased the debt from the 2010 election. Right now they've got $16.2 million in the bank. You're seeing And what worries me is, you know, we keep moving down the road. We've got 29 governors who are Republicans, 20 Democrats who are governors. And in this next year election, you're going to have, what, I think 9 Democrats defending their seats. We're only 5 Republicans. So, you know, if things don't go the right way, if people don't start waking up and paying attention, if we have another repeat of 2010, we could be in some serious trouble considering where the money's going. I look at Scott Brown's got $10 million in the bank for the 2012 campaign, raised $2 million in the second quarter of this year to fill his coffers. And we're seeing all this money being raised, and it's the billionaire class who are handing it out. Mitt Romney raised $18.25 million, $18.25 million in the second quarter, $18 million. He's got $12.6 million in the bank. Now, the neuter's got himself some problems. He raised about $2 million in the second quarter, which, $2 million, you got to go, wow, that's a lot of money. And, yeah, pay off his wife's debts. He's only got $225,000 in the bank. And some people are saying, well, no, he's in debt. He doesn't have that, even have that much, you know, because he owes out a bunch of money.
But his expenses aren't that much. He doesn't have a staff anymore. They all left.
Well, there is that.
They're going to work for the governor of Texas if he runs.
Well, yeah, there is that. Ron Paul raised $4.5 million. Palente raised $4.2 million. Huntsman raised over $4 million. Even Herman Cain raised $2.5 million. And I'm going, you know, there's all this money out there. Why don't we just say, you know what, no more of this far out. Let's start talking about elections 2 or 3 months before. Look at how much money they are just pissing away. We got debt problems, remember? I thought we were a country that was broke. What happened to we're broke? And we see these people raising millions and millions of dollars. For what? So that they can attack the president? So they can continue to attack, what progress has been made? So they continue to tear down the country? For their own benefit? Does that make any sense to you, Jake?
No. No, not at all. You made a good point about the money. I mean, the Republicans keep saying we're broke, we're broke, we're broke. No, not at all. We're a very, very wealthy country. The problem isn't that we don't have enough money. It's the redistribution of that wealth. That's the problem.
Oh, but Jake, you've said the swear word. You've said the dreaded R word. And, you know, again, I go back to the guy we talked to in the last segment. By closing down that facility, I mean, where are the presidential candidates there? Why don't we see someone going out there saying, wait a minute, hold on, this is wrong? I mean, at some point you got to say there's right and there's wrong and this is wrong. Throwing these guys out in the street who've spent 20, 30 years building that company, only to have on one day say, sorry, it's the tyranny of the marketplace. In defense of the market, you know, we made, you know, $4.7 billion in profit last year. That's just, sorry, not an acceptable profit. We need a little more, so we're going to have to outsource your job, bring in somebody who's going to do it for half the price.
And it'd be interesting. You're not making a small item here. You're making not only an automobile, but one of the premier automobiles in the world. Where are they going to get the people right off the street with the expertise to match the quality that these people can put into a car? That would be, first of all, as a consumer, that would be my first thought.
Well, this is their parts distribution center. They're not actually building the car. They're the people who pick the parts and make sure that all the parts get out to the different dealers and stuff, which I think is hugely important, especially if you're a dealer going, I need a radiator for a 1998, a BMW, blah, 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 and they send you a radiator for a 1984 BMW, blah, 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 and it's absolutely the wrong part. That's going to harm with your customers. You need qualified, skilled people, and these folks, 30-some years, most of them were there. And now they're being sent to the curb. Why? And I love the part where Bob said that, they couldn't say how much they were going to make from it. Are you telling me, and I, like, stop and think about this for a minute, are you telling me a huge multinational corporation like BMW doesn't know down to the dime where every penny is spent in that corporation? And who, they couldn't even say who the vendor was going to be, who the third-party logistics corporation was going to be to come in. I find that just unbelievable. And they, like the question I asked, is it that they couldn't or wouldn't say? And again, it comes back to they won't. You know, very close to the vest. Amazing stuff. But here's the thing. If there wasn't a union there, you'd have never heard about the story. It would have just happened. And, you know, for those folks who, I don't mean me, you know, stinking union, there's a perfect example of why you do. Because if there wasn't a voice there, if there wasn't a representative there, if there wasn't some legal entity there to represent those people, you'd have never heard, it had never made the newspaper, it had never, not a peep, nothing. It would have just happened.
Well, the sad part about it is, Rick, it does happen almost every day to non-union workers, and there's not a lot they can do about it. Basically nothing.
And I look at all this money we're putting into these campaigns, all this money we're putting into insane candidates. I mean, Rick Santorum, really? Does he stand a snowball's chance? But he's raising millions of dollars. Michelle Bachmann, raising millions of dollars.
She did very well.
She always does. She is very prolific at raising money.
I believe last month.
We should put her in charge of the deficit. Let her go out there and whore for money.
I believe in May she outraised Romney. I mean, she can raise money. I mean, you know, we write her off as
crazy salesman,
as this crazy woman, and she says absolutely ridiculous things that don't have a granite of truth in them. But yet, at a certain level, she's a formidable candidate in her own right.
You mean like women should be subservient to men? And
no,
the only reason that she went to law school is because her husband told her to?
I'm talking about the dumb things she says. Like
that's not dumb.
No, I didn't say that. But the founding, now this, you know, she says things like, well, the founding fathers worked tirelessly.
Light bulb.
To eliminate, the founding fathers worked tirelessly to eliminate slavery. Well, that's just not even close to being the truth. But that being said, now that's just plain stupid. But when she talks about what would happen to this country if we didn't lift the debt ceiling, and she poo-pooed it like, it wouldn't be all that bad, and you know, the Fed can do this and do that, and it'll be okay. Well, no, it won't be okay, because you're gonna affect the credit rating of this country. The people who are buying our debt are going to say, hey, you know, the United States, you can't rely on them anymore. They're not paying their bills. I mean, that's huge.
See, here's the thing. That's just wrong. You know, that's a matter of, we can argue back and forth. That's just wrong. When she says, you know, and what scares me, when she says something along the lines of, you know, women must be submissive to their men, I got a problem with that. That's just the wrong message. I don't want my daughters hearing that. That's a mentality. Rick, being wrong on an issue is one thing. Being completely lost in the 18th century is something completely
different. But a lot of conservatives, they agree with her. Oh, isn't she wonderful? She's one of us.
Yeah.
That's why she's going to do well in the primaries. Now, if she wins, that's a possibility. I don't think she will. But if she would win, then some of the things she has been saying on the stump going to come back to hurt her.
Well, we will see. And that's why we play the game, and that's why it's exciting stuff. And again, I love Michelle Bachmann.
And I do believe that she has a very good chance of winning in Iowa and probably South Carolina. At this point, I don't see Romney winning either one.
I wonder who the governor with the greatest name in porn has to say about that. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, back after this.
You're listening
to the Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much.
Big news on the debt talks.
Yes, indeed. There are going to be debt talks on Thursday at the White House. We've got congressional leaders coming to meet with the president and the vice president, and that in itself is an achievement because, you know, there's been so much trash talk, you'd never know that people are going to come to these meetings. This is an important one, really, because this is really the beginning of the end. They're actually starting to get close, partly because they're getting close to the date, and it tends to concentrate the mind. Also because House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said something interesting in his roundtable with reporters today. He said, if the president wants to talk loopholes, we'll be glad to talk loopholes. We've said all along that preferences in the code aren't something that helps economic growth overall, but listen, we're not for any proposal that increases taxes. And anyway, he went on, but basically he said they're willing to talk loopholes. And, of course, Senators Coburn and McCain on the Republican side have said that they're willing to talk over the weekend. But Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Minority Leader, has said he's open to tax reform, but to sort of cherry-pick items in this context of this current negotiation with the White House strikes me as pretty challenging, and basically said no.
So it's interesting. I mean, it looks like the Republicans are a little split.
Yes.
You know, because I was wondering who's going to blink first. I thought the president blinked first by saying, yeah, we'll put Medicare and Medicaid on the table. Now maybe there is some agreement already. They're just trying to figure out how to sell it.
I get that impression. There is a split among Republicans right now. You see, Mitch McConnell has his own agenda. He wants to win the Senate back for Republicans in 2012. And the more cynical among Washingtonians are saying he's not terribly interested in a debt deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes for good good copy and gets his name in the paper often. So good for him.
It sure does.
And the president today did something unusual, took to the Twitters.
It had never been done before. He had the first ever Twitter town hall, which was moderated by the founder of Twitter himself. The president tweeted a question to himself, which he then, of course, proceeded to answer in more than 140 characters. And then he took questions from all kinds of people at hashtag Ask Obama, from a number of different, all sorts of different people. And they were interesting, and people like Johnny Audacity, names like that. There was somebody called Renegade something or other. And it was on primarily the economy and jobs, but immigration, housing came into it as well. And one came from a young guy called John Boehner.
The John Boehner?
Yes.
Wow. And how'd that work?
It was interesting because Twitter allowed the tweet to come through, and it said, after embarking on a record spending binge that's left us deeper in debt, where are the jobs? And Obama, I think, wasn't desperately happy about it, but he handled it. He handles challenges well. So he handled it.
Yeah, now whenever you put yourself out into that position, you know, you gotta expect stuff like that. So basically what you're saying at the beginning, he wrote himself a question and he asked himself a question. So he basically was talking to himself.
That's exactly what he did.
Nice.
He talked to himself, seemed perfectly happy to do it. Or,
yeah. And talking about the elections coming up, the Republicans, we've got a ton of candidates out there, but everywhere I look across the country, all of the legislatures across the country seem to be doing this voter ID stuff, trying to figure out how to suppress the vote. I guess President Clinton weighed in on the voter suppression stuff today.
Yeah, he was speaking to some liberal youth activists, and he went off. There has never been in my lifetime since we got rid of the poll tax and all the Jim Crow burdens on voting, the determined effort to limit the franchise that we see today, he said. And he said, why is all this going on? This is not rocket science. They're trying to make 2012 electorate look more like the 2010 electorate than the 2008 electorate. And he went on. There's much more than that. But he cited state by state by state by state exactly what each state was doing. New Hampshire, what they're doing. Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, exactly what each state was doing. Now, the Republicans have responded. Republican State Leadership Committee has said it's not fair to paint all these proposals with the same broad brush. We support everyone who is entitled to vote, and to take issues with that, to be opposed to that principle means you're actually supporting illegal voting. I don't know quite what that means. Then he said, this is interesting, each party is free to do everything they should and possibly can to turn out their voters.
Well, to turn out their voters, not to suppress the other sides. You know,
well,
I get that. I get the whole get your people out to the polls, excite your base, have candidates worth supporting, you know, ideas worth supporting, get your people out. Yeah, I'm all in favor of that. But when you start saying that my 84-year-old grandmother, who hasn't driven a car in so many years, possibly going to the same voting poll for 45 years, now has to go get some ID, I got a problem with that.
Well, and so does President Bill Clinton.
Speaking of the president, President Obama doing something in history hasn't been done before. Actually, writing letters to the families of soldiers who have committed suicide.
Yeah, this is really very interesting. They've changed that policy this week. President Wang has changed it since December 2009, so it's taken a year and a half to decide. The review apparently was exhaustive and difficult, as this is an emotional, painful, and complicated issue. And as a result of the review, the president issued a statement today talking about how grateful he was for the service of all these men and women in uniform and grieving for the loss of those who suffer from the wounds of war, seen and unseen, and said he didn't make this decision lightly, and this issue is emotional, painful, and complicated, but these Americans served our nation bravely. They didn't die because they were weak. And the fact that they didn't get the help they needed must change, he said.
I'm in favor of it, to be honest. You know, I remember back when I was a kid growing up in the housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and I saw those guys coming back from Vietnam, broken with missing arms, legs, broken minds, drug and alcohol problems, and those poor men were just dumped back into our community with no help whatsoever. So I think this is a step in the right direction. Now maybe we fund getting those people treatment and stopping them from committing suicide in the first place.
I think they're trying to work on that.
Lastly, today they opened up the border, trying to make nice with Mexico. I guess we're doing something to maybe not make nice with them now?
Well, there's a guy on death row in Texas who was convicted back in 1994 for a really revolting rape and murder. The only problem is that the guy was not advised of his right to speak with Mexican consular officials after his arrest. He's a Mexican citizen, and he's allowed to under the U.S. ratified 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. And so it gets very complicated, but the fact of the matter is that the U.S. Supreme Court now has until tomorrow to intervene before Texas is scheduled to put him to death. And basically it's Rick Perry and the Supreme Court who's got to decide, the governor of Texas. Rick Perry has already indicated, I think he can go. So basically the people who are pleading for him to live are President Barack Obama, President George W. Bush, the United Nations, the Solicitor General, and any number of diplomats and judges, senior military officers, you name it. Everybody is saying, please, you have no idea the damage you are doing internationally to treaties and to Americans abroad.
Yeah, that's a tough call there. I mean, the people who are, I'm not a death penalty person, but, you know, some folks who are say, you know, you murdered and killed somebody, raped and killed them. You deserve what you get. But, you know, I understand in the larger context, that, you know, there's much bigger issue out there than this one guy.
Well, there's one more piece, which is that Congress is looking to pass a law that will prevent him from being put to death. Along with dozens of other foreign nationals who were denied proper access to diplomatic representation before trials for capital crimes, because the Supreme Court said that Congress has to make this decision. But in the meantime, it can go ahead. It's incredibly complex. But this bill has been introduced by Patrick Leahy, but it's unlikely to win the approval of both houses of Congress before next year. And in the meantime, if this execution is not put on hold until the law is passed, he's going to die.
Yeah. And the president can do nothing? I mean, it's a state issue, I guess. The president can't intervene?
He can't intervene. It's up to the Supreme Court.
Interesting. We'll see. We'll find out tomorrow how this turns.
We will.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what we've got going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Story coming out of the Harrisburg Patriot on a meeting of some environmental groups. Apparently they differ on how to reach the goal of energy independence. The natural gas industry and environmental groups in Pennsylvania agree on at least one thing. It would be good for the United States to be independent of foreign oil. While the various companies in the gas industry, predictably, have been able to present a united front through the Marcellus Shale Coalition, no similar anonymity of purpose is evident from the environmental lobby. That was illustrated again on Tuesday during a Penn Environmental press conference at the Capitol Rotunda. Penn Environment, one of the relatively outspoken anti-drilling groups, presented a plan to transition Pennsylvania off oil. Cars should be required to get 60 miles to the gallon by 2025, they said, while greater investments should be made in public transportation and alternate domestic energy. The plan predictably was silent on any role natural gas might play. In fact, it would play no role at all in Penn environmental vision, according to a spokesman. Others lined up in support of the plan had similar but a little bit different view. Representative Greg Vitale from Delaware, who has been on this show, said natural gas in the process of hydrofracking to get it was not going away, and he included natural gas in his list of things that could help wean Pennsylvania off oil. Now, as much as they disagree, some of the people who have retired from the military have one objective. Take a man by the name of Tim Deal. Tim Deal is a retired Air Force Master Sergeant who served in Iraq. Deal said he led 12 Americans in Operation Iraqi Freedom and was responsible for making sure those young men and women returned home to their families. That's an awesome responsibility, something we shouldn't be putting on anyone because we can't wean ourselves from foreign oil, according to him. Every day we send $1 billion overseas for oil, much of which ends up in the hands of terrorists or nations that don't share American values, according to Deal. Clean energy makes America stronger at home and around the world, and I say amen. There's no question in my mind that one of the reasons we went into Iraq was to protect our oil supply, and if we wean ourselves off oil, we take away that danger. In the long term, we must.
Light bulb.
Amen. Amen, Rick. Temple University, now this doesn't surprise anybody, Temple University increases tuition by about 10%, and it blames state cuts. Temple University in Philadelphia is hiking annual tuition by about 10% this fall to make up for deep cuts in state aid. Temple announced today that both in-state and out-of-state residents will pay about $1,200 more in the incoming year. Tuition for Pennsylvania students will cost just over $13,000, up from about $11,800. By the way, Rick, this week a press release came out And in that press release, it was revealed that Penn State has become the most expensive state university in the country to enroll in. So already we see some real adverse effects thanks to Governor Corporate's budget on education. Some good news coming out of Idaho. We see in more and more states workers are fighting back. Earlier this year, the Ohio Attorney General warned the Republican legislators that an anti-union bill that they were pushing was likely illegal, would be overturned. The Attorney General apparently was right. Last week in Boise, a federal judge blocked a new state law that was due to go into effect that day, saying that it conflicted with federal labor law. The Idaho and the Southwest Idaho Bill League and Construction Trades Council filed suit against the law that would have banned unions from subsidizing workers' wages to help union contractors win bids, a practice known as job targeting and permitted by the NLRB. So it's a good development. You couple that with what happened in Wisconsin, ongoing effort there where it looks like the labor movement will be successful in probably helping the Democrats to regain the Senate, thereby putting an end to the reign of terror. That governor in Ohio, it looks like the workers have been successful in getting a proposition on the ballot concerning, I think it was SB5. That was a bill that took workers' rights away from state workers to actually form a union. So in more and more states, looks like workers are fighting back. So that's good news. Little news coming out of what has been an ongoing saga, the saga of Jane Orey, state senator. She was brought up on trial. She was accused of misusing political funds, public funds for political purposes. Several months ago, there was a trial, and in the midst of the trial, it was declared a mistrial because there were some documents that were discovered that were supposedly forged. Since that time, the defense has accused the prosecution, which was the district attorney out there, by the way, a Democrat, Jane Orey, Melvin is a Republican. They accused the prosecution of being responsible for that. Prosecution said, oh, no, when we got those documents, they were already forged. Now, the documents in question came from Senator Jane Orey's office, and it was a memo to her people. And in this memo, she supposedly said that they were only supposed to work on political campaigns basically on their own time. Now, the problem was the prosecution claims that they were backdated, and therein lies the forgery. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, these are high stakes. This trial could ruin Jane Orey Melvin's career and her sister, who's a Supreme Court justice, and they could wind up in prison, actually. So there's a lot at stake. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. Back to you.
All righty. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back, wrap things up. Right back after this.
Save the USA, drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA, every consumer has its mind. Stop taking all our money and shipping it onshore. Do the job and join the union.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed a permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or are about to retire, the Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, inattention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, Rob Andrews is right. I mean, there's the right is going to frame this as some grand conspiracy, you know, to save those pensions that for years, like here in Pennsylvania, for years, Republican governors and the legislature just walked away from. So we don't, times are good. We don't have to contribute to it. Nah, that's all right. We're just going to pocket that money. In fact, we're going to tell the communities, we're going to tell the voters, we saved money. Now you turn around, you see what's going on. Just like this budget this guy passed here recently. This is just kicking the can, the trouble down the road. And we're going to pay the cost. We're going to pay. Trust me, we're going to end up paying for their political victory. We're going to pay for their quote-unquote win. This is not winning. This is screwing me 5 years from now. And then asking me to thank them today. Amazing stuff. I'm just amazed that folks, you know, buy into this. It's scary, scary stuff. President Obama has named an openly gay veteran to the West Point of Advisory Board. She's the co-founder of Nights Out. Her name is Brenda Fulton. She's been named to the visitors of the United States Military Academy. And you look at this and you go, is this just, got to be honest, is this just Obama going, you know what, I'm going to stick my thumb in somebody's eye because I can. And we were talking about this earlier today. I would be doing stuff like that just to upset them, just to get the, you know, to get them all riled up and all bunched up in the panties and frustrated. Which is, I guess, why I'll never be president, because I am sometimes can be petty like that. But I got to be honest, this person's probably the best person for the job. I don't know that their sexual orientation played into it, and I hope it didn't. I hope that, you know, she does what, you know, she's supposed to do. But here's the thing. The president, I'm hoping this isn't considered a blank. There's talk that there's a deal. There's going to be some discussion tomorrow. The president's going to lay out maybe some cuts to Medicare, maybe some cuts to Social Security. Is this one of those moments where, you know, the president's going, here, this is on the table. You're going to have to raise taxes. It's going to have to happen. I don't know. We will find out tomorrow, because I guess the big announcement, the big discussion will be tomorrow at the big meeting. Maybe the Republicans will come up with another storming out event. Maybe they'll put on another performance for us to partake in. Another storming out, another angry. Maybe it'll be McConnell this time, since McConnell seems to be the one who wants the showdown. Since he seems to be the one who's willing to push this to the end of the road, should be interesting to see tomorrow where this goes, Jake. Because at the end of this. Cuts to Social Security and cuts to Medicare politically, I think, are a loser for the president and for the Democrats. Now, you know, there's some cuts that can be made, I think, if you target them properly, you know, to where they're not harmful to the people who absolutely need Social Security and Medicare. There can be some things done, but I tend to believe the Republicans will fight hardest for the people who need it the least.
Well, I guess my question is, first of all, I agree with you on Medicare. there are things that can be done that can be very minimal as far as hurting people. You can cut down on some of the profits that are made within the system. I guess my question would be, are the Republicans really going to allow Obama to get away with that? I mean, let's be honest. This is a high-stakes political game. This could be very crucial to his reelection bid. And it'd be interesting to see what comes out of it. Now, I guess what I don't quite understand, and maybe to be fair, I should wait to see what the deal is. But, you know, he always has the option of lifting that debt ceiling when Congress isn't in session. And they asked him
about that,
and he said,
"Congress is not going to be out of session."
Well, but apparently there's some people who believe that will happen, and in the not too distant future, let's take that just for argument's sake, it happens. The president's argument right now is, "Well, yeah, I could do that, but it's Congress's responsibility. He is right there." So I guess what he is saying, if he would do that, if that opportunity would present itself and he would do that. I guess what I'm taking from that is the president feels that that might be a negative on his administration, but we shall see. But if he gives away too much, that will definitely, I can tell you right now, that will definitely hurt him in his presidential bid.
So it shall be quite interesting to see where this goes tomorrow. I'm excited to, hey, you know, this is interesting stuff. Let's see how bad we're going to get screwed in this. Because, again, I'm of the mindset that Democrats cave. That's what they do. This is going to be a huge cave, and it's going to end up being an issue in the 2012 election, and it's really going to cost them. I can only hope. I can only hope the other way, but that's it. So that'll be something we'll be focusing on tomorrow night. A couple other quick stories I came across of interest. How would you like to go to a school like the one in Uganda? They sent in the Anti-Mine Network group to teach, you know, teachers and students how to recognize landmines, you know, how to recognize the bombs because the country's full of them. They've been at war for so long, so they're trying to teach people, you know, just, you know, make sure that they keep themselves safe. Turns out the one school they went to, they were actually using an unexploded bomb as a bell. How would you have to go to that school? Hammering on a bomb. Come on to dinner. Come on to lunch.
And it exploded?
No. It's just when they went to train these people on how to find a landmine, how to find bombs, and there they are, one right in the classroom, and they're using it as a bell.
Wow.
That's one of those...
Light bulb.
It's one of those moments. I love that movie. Yeah, I generally don't, you know, talk about movies, but Despicable Me has just, you know, watched it with my kids. Funny movie. I love that movie. Especially.
Light bulb.
Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests tonight. Again, you know, tonight, one of those nights, you know, talking about the budget, talking about the state of work in this country. I don't know how you can't be frustrated and angry and willing to register to vote, willing to get involved and roll your sleeves up and get ready to, you know, scuffle about. This is a country that evidently loves war. This is war, folks. This is class war. They are stealing your lunch. And I look at that BMW situation, man. Wow. That they can get away with that. And there isn't mass outrage. Look at this budget. There isn't mass outrage. That's why we're here. We'll see you tomorrow night. Have a great night. Back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming. To the USA.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
The only thing she dislikes more than his.